Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Brown University pre-college programs, where high school students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses are available. precollege.brown.edu.
This is Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We kick things off with medical ethicist Art Kaplan about the downsides of do-it-yourself genetic testing. Instead of 23andMe, should it be 23andTherapy? We'll look at why DNA kits are driving people to the couch. Then Malcolm Little went from being a hoodlum peddling drugs and prostitution to becoming Malcolm X, one of history's most controversial civil rights leaders. His autobiography is the focus of the Boston Public Radio Book Club, with Irene Monroe and Alex Beam leading the way. At noon, we open the lines and ask you about Bob Kraft, charged with soliciting prostitution as part of a police sting on human trafficking. If CTE and concussions didn't compel you to boycott the NFL, will this? Then Attorney General Maura Healey is here for this month's edition of Ask the AG, taking our questions and your calls. That and more is coming up on Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio, broadcasting from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim's going to be here in about an hour. He's a little late today. Anyway, in 2017, 47,000 Americans died of opioid overdoses. This epidemic is compelling states to get tougher on drug dealers, including creating laws that treat fatal overdoses as murders and manslaughters. We already know how the president feels about this.
If we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So if the plan is to have laws that treat drug dealers as murderers, shouldn't those laws also apply to the big pharma executives who helped to get us hooked on opioids in the first place? Joining us for his take on this, a new bill introduced on Beacon Hill to tackle youth football and other medical headlines, is Art Kaplan, the Drs. William F. and Virginia Conley Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hi, Art Kaplan. How are you?
Good morning. By the way, I'm laughing. You dismissed Jim's not being there very, very quickly. So like, yeah, well, okay, so we got to move on.
We do. I think he's stuck in traffic, Art, or some cockamamie excuse.
He's probably got his head in an MRI.
Exactly. Well, we've talked about the opioid epidemic endlessly with you. Obviously, it's a huge tragedy. There is a move afoot to push the death penalty or life in prison on people who sell fentanyl, get tougher on drug dealers. What do you think about this?
I favor it. I can't believe the president and I are somewhat in agreement here. I'm not a death penalty person. I don't think that's needed. But if you treat people who distribute drugs where deaths result and you can trace back to the dealer, I would bring them in for some degree of homicide. I don't know if it's, first-degree murder, but I think you should be able to charge them. We do it now with people who sell alcohol, and someone goes out and has a terrible car accident and kills somebody. The bartender can be held responsible for selling liquor to someone who is impaired. You know, we've got parents responsible for what happens at a party if they have liquor there and kids getting trouble. I think the idea of deeper responsibility makes a lot of sense. And I would take it back to the drug company executive.
Well,
I don't know that you're ever going to get them arrested for murder, but let's at least arrest some of them.
We already have pretty stiff penalties for, under federal law, penalty of up to 20 years to life in prison, providing drugs that cause fatal overdoses. We have some pretty serious laws right now. I'm surprised you said that in a sense because, we have this Sackler family being sued by the Attorney General in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. They're people that really pushed these drugs on doctors, salesmen, and ultimately people who died from them. We have this other federal trial going on in Boston now with criminal charges, racketeering charges involving another major pharmaceutical company who did the same thing. So I guess I'd say, so the millionaires and billionaires, that are making all the profits are going to make out better than the street dealers? It doesn't seem quite right to me.
Well, here's what I'm saying. We've never done anything to the pharma companies about any scandals except fine them.
Right.
When they price gouge or do whatever they're going to do. I'm happy to try and get some of these people arrested and perp-walked and facing judges. I don't need to charge that group with murder. I just need to charge them with complicity. I just need to rattle the saber and say, you know what? In the future, you distribute drugs knowingly that are dangerous, you're going to face some prison time. And I promise you the white-collar crowd will not be doing that. They are deterrable without executing them or, you know, giving them a life sentence. I just like to drag them into jail, and they're going to have the fancy lawyers and the fancy defenses and the case precedents that work against, you know, charging them with murder, because they're going to say, well, who did you kill and did you know? You can't bring in a particular victim, and it passed through too many hands before it got to the dead junkie in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. But let's still figure out ways to charge them. White-collar criminals in the pharma industry will be weenies. They do not want to face jail time
right.
of any sort. So that will do it. Let's get there. And that's why I'm supportive of the Healey indictments and so on. I think that's the right direction there. We don't enforce the drug laws, as far as I can see, about the dealers. And that would scare them off. They may need a little bit more scaring because they're, you know, the criminal justice system is chasing them around all day long. So you may need to threaten them with tougher penalties. But I do think we ought to be tougher. And again, I'm not a death penalty person. So
okay. Okay.
We need to do that. But.
Well, let's get back to something else we talked to you all about all the time, concussions and injuries from football. There is, in Massachusetts here, state lawmakers are thinking about banning full contact sport for young players, kids that are under 12 years old, just getting rid of it altogether. Not football, but tackle football. What do you think?
Yay!
Okay.
Hooray!
All right. You're with it.
This is a really good idea. You don't need to be playing tackle football when you're 10 years old. You don't really get better at the game when you start playing at 10 because you're too small and you're not fully formed, if you will. The way to reduce injuries from football is play less of it. That's the real strategy. It isn't equipment. It's less contact. So start the contact later. That makes sense. When you're 9, 10 years old, don't you think you're playing a little bit because your parents are pressuring you and you're getting a lot of peer pressure? Whereas if you're in high school, you can sort of say, I don't want to. Nope, not for me.
Yeah.
I'm headed toward swimming or tennis or whatever. You get a little more choice. You're a little older. So I think this is overdue. I think flag football, great. Things that involve less contact, great. But yeah, I don't see any basis for peewee midget football, despite the fact that it seems to be all the rage in Texas and places.
Yeah, our reporter, Mike Dean, interviewed the Hanson Youth Football League president, and he said that that they've already changed to limit head injuries and teach players safer ways to tackle. He's quoted as saying if they eliminated tackle football, it would be a tough pill to swallow for a lot of kids because there are a lot of kids who just genuinely love the sport. That's Damon Stanton. What do you say to Mr. Stanton?
Play flag.
Yeah.
You know, just cut down on the contact. You might even go to 8-man teams, which opens the field up and you have less blocking. You got more passing and running. You know, there's fewer people to run into, so to speak. The funny thing about football is, despite all the talk about teaching technique and better helmets, the number one way to prevent injuries, concussions, and other injuries is to play less or have less contact. And so that's what we got to do. You got to make the game safer on the field by having people not hit each other as much, and you got to start later.
By the way, for people that don't know about this, this is a bipartisan bill. It's not got that many members up in Beacon Hill supporting it so far, and Charlie Baker has not yet weighed in. But we'll see what happens. A lot of people are...
You know, if you want to save the game of football, because there are declining participation rates in high school football, you're going to have to go in this direction. It's the only way to preserve it. I'm not saying preserve it for next year or in 5 years, but in 20 years, there's not going to be too much of a fan base for football if no one's willing to play it.
So Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, Beth Tytel, who's a great writer for the Boston Globe, has got another hysterical story here. It's not really so funny because people are traumatized by what they find out. But we all think, I bought one of these for my sister for Christmas, one of these Ancestry.com DNA kits, you know, and you figure you can kind of investigate your relatives and your ancestors, where everybody came from and all this kind of stuff. Well, apparently, people are finding out things that they are devastated by. One woman found out she was not the biological child of the man she called daddy her entire life. She was a basket case over that, understandably. Lots of people are finding out that they're not actually the sister of their sister, or that they were the product of incest. I mean, really horrible things. The headline of the story is, first came the home DNA kits, now come the support groups. The people going into therapy about what they find out on these Ancestry.com, et cetera. What do you make of it?
Well, it leads to some interesting new Christmas carols, you know. Merry Christmas to you. Dad's not your dad. And sis was made at a sperm bank.
Yeah.
Look, what's happened is we've taken genetic testing and turned it into a game. Trivial, right?
Mm-hmm.
Get this for the holidays. It'll be a lot of fun. Find out if you're truly Lithuanian, all that kind of stuff. The tests aren't that accurate. I don't think they can really tell your ethnic group. I hear there are all kinds of people arranging, by the way, travel tours to places that turned up on their DNA testing, recreational testing kits, you know, the true homeland. I thought I was German, but not Spain kind
of
stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the whole thing is a mess. First of all, you shouldn't be doing DNA testing for ancestry. If you go back far enough, everybody's going to be in Africa. I keep laughing about DNA testing for ancestry. I'm waiting for somebody to get a test back that says, Art, your ancestors lived in some tiny town in Poland, and they were rag pickers and did nothing useful to society. See you later. You know, everybody's like the queen or the duke or the sea captain or the somebody. There's like no – so and you need counseling. Somebody's got to be ready to help you and interpret the results, you know. And how about a little warning? You may find out things about paternity and maternity that you didn't want to know. So here's a warning. And if you do, they shouldn't just say things like, well, call your local state genetic counseling association, which is what they do now.
Well, I mean, it's
terrible.
It's kind of like, you know, all the travails of Facebook. Started out as a nice idea. Let's show everybody baby pictures and family vacations. And now we find out that everyone's stealing our information. And this is the same thing.
There's even some of that going on in the 23andMe world and the Ancestry and some of these other sites, because what they really want is your DNA. Remember, you send it to them in that little envelope. They keep it, and then they sell it to third parties who pay them because they want to use it for research. There's a GSK 23andMe deal that got concluded earlier, I think this year or last year. So they're doing a little bit of bait and switch, too. It's like, ha-ha, you know, a lot of fun. Find out if you should wear lederhosen. Oops, now we got your sample. We're going to sell it to a company and make some real money, not trivial money off selling these kits.
Wow. And then are you not notified of this, I take it? Or are you?
Well, it's buried in that, you know, 30-page boilerplate thing. That says we could use this for research, but it doesn't really say how or what, or, and it's in the tiny type, if you want to put it that way.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Everybody knows AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new congresswoman out of the Bronx. She's all over the place all the time. I guess she had a bunch of people over to her kitchen, was making chili, and gave an interview about basically a lot of things, but one of the most controversial moves, and this is according to a story in Fox News, she asked if there's a legitimate question about whether it's okay to still have children with the terrible things that are coming from climate change in the world. What do you make of it?
You know, this is like people are chasing her around and getting every stray thought that flies out. There's a little bit of this is what I had to say in the dorm room last week kind of phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if we should ever have children. Do you think the robots are going to kill us all? I don't know. Look, climate change is real. We got to do something about it. But controlling it by having children takes decades. That is not the answer to solving current climate change things. The people who are here now have to put less of a burden on the environment, need to come up with energy sources that are more environmentally friendly. We can't wait, you know, and say, well, you know, we're just not going to have kids and they won't have kids. Half the world isn't paying any attention to that anyway. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of the view that we shouldn't have any children as a solution to either food problems or environmental problems. I think what we got to do is use resources responsibly. But it's pretty draconian to say, you know, no more babies.
Haven't we heard this decade after decade? I mean,
yeah.
we weren't supposed to have any children because of the nuclear, you know, we're all going to get blown up in the nuclear war. Then we weren't supposed to have children because we have overpopulation. I mean, this does seem to be kind of a recurring theme. And the story's a little odd. Like I said, I was in her apartment. She's making chili. She's talking about a bunch of things, including the fact that she had to move to a new apartment because apparently she was getting death threats, at least that's what she said, at her old apartment. And then it's just kind of like a free-form shooting the breeze kind of thing.
That's what I meant when I was sort of making that wisecrack about dorm room talk. You know, it's kind of like we could be hanging around saying, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think aliens are going to come soon and kill us all so we don't have to worry about climate change anyway?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, I don't know. You could speculate and ramble, but I almost didn't want to take that seriously. Everything the poor woman says now is sort of slapped into the headlines. I think that's partly because her opponents want to use her to vilify her party. It's because partly she's young and provides a youthful face to the average age of leading Democrats is 158.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason she's there. She does have some fresh ideas. I don't mean to say she doesn't, but boy, she's getting a lot of play for somebody who, what was she doing before she won this election?
I think she was
like
a bartending or a waitress or something like that. You know, Art Kaplan, have you weighed in? There may not be, it's not really, well, maybe it is. Have you weighed in on the ethics of the Green New Deal, or is that not in your purview?
Oh, it's a little bit in my purview, and I'm not against parts of it. I think it's something to really take seriously and debate. It needs more meat on the policy proposal, but I think Democrats and some Republicans would find themselves with a lot of support, interestingly enough, from the American people if they said, you know, here's how we're going to handle conservation, here's what our policy is about energy, here's what we're thinking about in terms of emissions, here's how we're going to try and reform agriculture to make it more environmentally friendly and less water pollution, blah, 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 blah. I don't think that's an oddball, fringy view. I think that's a view that a lot of people would like to hear, you know, substantive ideas about. Do they want to get burdened with massive lifestyle changes? No, but everything, you know, is incremental. So I like it. I mean, I think they should. The Democrats, I think, would have a winning issue to talk about being green.
Yeah. Art Kaplan, it seems as though there's a recurring theme. I guess it's been going on for forever when people don't understand or claim they don't understand how their technology is going to be used. DNA, Ancestry.com. Now we have this massive surveillance control system in China that basically forcing people to get these so-called medical exams, although I guess they don't really check your heart or your kidneys or your blood pressure, but they're looking at your iris of your eyes and taking your fingerprints and stuff. But this story out of the New York Times implicates a Massachusetts company, Thermo Fisher, and Kenneth Kidd, a Yale University geneticist, in giving some of the equipment or selling some of the equipment to China that's enabled them to carry out this campaign.
Yeah, this bothered me. I actually participated in that story. So we have a lot of genetic techniques, the same kind of things we were talking about earlier with Ancestry and 23andMe and these other kind of Know Your Ancestors companies. There are some very heavy-hitting, serious science genetic analysis companies like Thermo based out of Massachusetts, probably more accurate and detailed than many of the sort of buy this for Christmas kits. And they've been doing business with the Chinese. And it doesn't take a big Google search to realize that the Chinese are interested in ethnicity because they're really trying to repress the Tibetans and the Uyghurs and other sort of minority groups in the country. They fear that they're trying to break away or creating social unrest. So I think you got to go in eyes open and say, well, we're not going to sell that technology to Chinese police agencies because I don't think it's really a health thing. It's clearly, let's find out who's who and where they are, and then we'll start surveilling them and maybe rounding them up, I think. If I'm not mistaken, there are already camps where they're trying to reform, quote unquote.
Exactly. Well, you were quoting this piece as saying that there's a certain naivete on the part of these scientists.
You know, it's part of this idea that we can exchange ideas, and it's the open exchange of ideas in science that makes it go. But we don't believe that, for example, in physics. Nobody's had an open exchange idea policy about nuclear weapons or missiles to shoot down other missiles. You know, it's all, I think, Lincoln Labs at MIT, you have to have a security clearance to work there. They don't just invite anybody from around the world to come be a postdoc there. Biology, genetics hasn't sort of gone in that direction, but I think it's going to have to think about it because you can really use genetic technology to hurt people, to take advantage of them, to round them up, to do bad things. And I think we've got to start to put in policies that say, look, we're not sharing some of our technology with police agencies or national security agencies. And as long as I'm ranting, we have to have that discussion about our own security agencies, right? What's the FBI or national security agency seeing in our DNA databases?
So I should point out that this Thermo Fisher company has said, after learning about what was going on, that it's no longer going to be selling its equipment to this part of China that's trying to track this minority group of people.
By the way, I saw that. So they said, you know, okay, we won't sell it to the police agency in the, let's call it, Uyghur region.
Yeah,
I think that's what they said. Are you kidding me? There's 97 other provinces with police agencies, I think. Just saying I'm not going to sell it, and that one isn't going to stop the Chinese security apparatus. So I'm not sure that's the adequate response there.
Okay, one last thing, Art, before we talk about your Everyday Ethics podcast. I guess they've got big-time obesity problems in Great Britain and London, as we do in the United States, and they are mostly affecting poor people.
Obesity, boy, it's the hidden epidemic. If you wanted to make something part of a no more children policy, you'd be better off saying, how about trying to really work on obesity? That's a better public health approach to solving a lot of healthcare costs, reducing environmental burdens by growing foods that are, you know, sugary and fat and take up all kinds of land mass in Australia and the U.S. and other things. So it's a disease of the poor. It doesn't get enough attention. It's been exploding. I'm sorry, bad pun. It's been, you know, getting worse and worse. And we don't seem to be spending money to find answers to how to help people maintain weight or lose weight. We're spending a ton of money on cancer and precision medicine, and we got major, you know, projects going on all kinds of other diseases, but that's one that just seems to not draw the funds. It's as if the public health side just gets no money, and yet it's really key to controlling a lot of these health epidemics. What I'm saying is we don't really know how to convince people or persuade them or educate them to change their lifestyle. Lifestyle change is a pretty tough thing, pretty tough thing.
All right, Kaplan, we're running low on time here, so what's on the Everyday Ethics podcast?
Just very quickly, we're going to take a look at, do we work too hard? Does everybody have a side gig? I don't know what yours is, Marjorie, but
I have
I
one.
Write columns. Yep, there's one. And people say, oh, that's good. But is it good, or are we just driving ourselves crazy because we think we should work all the time?
You know, I ask myself that question every day, Art Kaplan.
And we will answer it for you.
Okay. I'll be listening. Thank you very much, Art. Great to talk to you, as
Thanks,
always.
Marjorie.
Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's a doctor. He's William F. from Virginia Colony Committee Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Coming up, He was a hustler, a militant radical, an Islamic convert, and one of history's most controversial civil rights figures. The autobiography of Malcolm X is the focus of today's Boston Public Radio Book Club. We're going to talk about Malcolm X next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Welcome back to Boston Public Library, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy is still delinquent, but he's going to be here at noontime. It's time for our BPR book club. We'll proceed without him. This month marks the 54th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, and we're looking at his life and legacy today with the autobiography of Malcolm X, who predicted he wouldn't live to see it published, and he was right, a prophecy that was fulfilled when he was shot by members of the Nation of Islam a few days before he was killed. He told reporters, "I live like a man who is dead already. I have no fear whatsoever of anybody or anything." And it's an attitude that persists throughout this book. Joining us to lead the conversation are the Reverend Irene Monroe and Alex Beam. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston's voice for Detour's African-American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology, and Alex Beam, a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book is The Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the End of a Beautiful Friendship. Irene and Alex, great to have you both here. We'll take your calls on this when we get a little ways into it, 877-301-8970. Do you recognize his America, that is Malcolm X's America in 2019? Is he relatable? Do you like this not just as a biography, but as a literary accomplishment? Okay, the maitre d' of this book club is Alex Beam over there. Take it away, Alex.
Okay. Well, welcome to the restaurant. I'm really happy we read this book.
Me too.
I just loved it, and I'm going to maybe briefly situate it in time and try and say what it is. It's the autobiography of Malcolm X as told to Alex Haley, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Roots. And to be fair, this is a beautifully crafted and written book. Mm-hmm. It is super readable. It doesn't feel that long. The so-called arc of the story is familiar to many people. Malcolm Little has a kind of a, as you say, sort of a youth and background as a hustler. He gets arrested here in Boston under fascinating circumstances. Mm-hmm. Basically goes to what we now call Norfolk MCI. Gets a religion, the so-called black Muslim religion, and gets an education, and he becomes this sort of super autodidact, and then he becomes a public figure, which we'll get into it later. I just have to say, it's a great book. I also have to specifically recommend, this may be the best buy in an American bookstore. It's cost $6.
I know, it's unbelievable.
But wait, there's more. I feel like a salesman, a vacuum cleaner salesman. Yeah, you not only get the book for $6, you get a foreword by Malcolm X's daughter.
Yeah.
You get a lengthy afterword by Alex Haley, because astonishingly and darkly, this book is published in the same year that Malcolm is assassinated in New York. So you get Haley's lengthy description of the circumstances surrounding Malcolm's death. And then, incredibly, one of the great pieces of writing is like a 2.5 to 3-page appreciation by the actor Ossie Davis,
that's right.
Which is bleeping well written. Over to you.
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting here. It's one of the best, what I would depict as autobiographies of the last century. And one of the things that the book does, it really picks up the sort of African-American literary style. I mean, you see two central characters, really, in Malcolm. You see the hustler, trickster, that's one particular character, and then you see the public intellectual and minister, and present-day examples of that is certainly someone like Cornel West, but we also see that clearly in MLK here. This book, I mean, when I talk about it being a mixed genre, I mean, it's a black male's talking book, it is a survivor's guide, and it's a Bible. So when I was reading this book, and I have to say, this is my reading of the book. Okay,
so
the copy that I had when I was 17 years old, I couldn't. I mean, the pages are frayed. But there was another thing here: where I was at 17 and where I am now, the noticeable changes. Wow, the type is really small. I really noticed that. But one of the things you pick up in the book here, you pick up Booker T. Washington's up from slavery. There's that narrative in there. You see David Walker's, you know, manifesto around, you know, debunking and critiquing white supremacy here. It is the legacy of this book becomes that talking book for really black male survival. And the interesting thing is that the more things change, actually, the more they remain the same. Because what are some of the tropes we see here? Police brutality, mass incarceration, poor urban schools, the denigration, if not demonization, of black urban culture, you know, from wearing the zoot suit to now black men wearing hoodies.
And the conk hairdo that you talked about, how you burned your head with lye to make your hair look more like a white man's hair, which he thought was so disgraceful later on in his life. But it was something he did as a teenager. You know, before we get to the Boston part, because you've got lists of the streets and everything else. But briefly, you know, he grew up in a very in a family that fell apart when his father was murdered
by the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. You know, bashed in the head, and as the story tells, it left on a trolley track, so his body was essentially cut in half. His mother's left at home, poverty-stricken, to deal with these children. She's really poor. It finally drives her. It's never clear whether she actually had mental illness or whether they just took these. You know, she just was worn down from the tragedy of her life. But anyway,
he grows up as
an orphan, essentially. Yeah. But from an early age, so charming, so attractive to people, you know, able to get away from the home and go to other people's houses and really sort of thrive in a bad boy kind of way as a kid. And then he comes to Boston.
He's astonishingly successful in everything he does.
Well, he's a genius. That's the other thing.
That's the label that he doesn't get.
And you have to skate over some of these kind of classic, and this is a really poor metaphor, but sort of weird stations of the cross for African Americans in the mid-century. I mean, he works on the railways, you know, for the Pullman Company, as many African Americans did. He does street hustles. He does pimping. He does shoe shining. It's almost unbelievable. But one of my favorite, actually, geographical confluences in this book is that sort of the last great crimes in his last great episode in crime is when he has this mixed race burglary ring. They rent. In Boston.
Yeah.
But unbelievably, they need a place to meet, to kind of collect the loot. And so they rent a ground floor apartment across from the Harvard Law School Mass Ave, where I guess a mere 15 years later, as Malcolm X, he will be invited by the Students Association to give a talk, et cetera, et cetera.
They're running his first lectures, actually.
Yeah. I'll just finish with, someone else should maybe pick up the Norfolk story, which is quite incredible. But what gets him, according to his own account, what gets him a 7 to 8 years, a rather long sentence for burglary, is precisely the fact that he's working with whites, and the judge picks up that his girlfriend is white,
right?
And throws the
his
book
married
at him.
Girlfriend,
yeah, for that purpose.
And the interesting thing, we see these tropes, you know, not only in literature, but we also see them in life. So what happens is that these white girls, they get a much lighter sentence here. And Malcolm would have gotten a much stiffer sentence if the girlfriend had acquiesced to what the police wanted her to do and say it was rape. So here we again, once again, get this narrative of black men raping white women. I thought of Malcolm. He's brilliant in that he is a what I call a shapeshifter. And it's out of survival because of the various names. He's Malcolm Little. He's Homeboy. He's Detroit Red. He's, you know,
Harlem Red.
Harlem Red.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's, you know, Malachi Shabazz to the final, you know, name that he takes on here. And so we see different phases of the different names really sort of punctuate the arc of his life.
Let me put you on the spot, if you don't mind.
Yeah, put
me. Because I know I sent you an email to this effect. But the first 200 to 300 pages, I have a highly sexualized sort of analysis of the relationship between whites and blacks, and I can either.
Oh, he talks about it all the time.
Yeah. I mean, what do you, plural or singular, make of that?
Well, I think some of the one of the historical antecedents is just slavery. The whole idea of if you demonize black sexuality or you demonize the whole notion of black and whites getting together here, you will always have that kind of race divide. But one of the things here I need to say, when we talk about Malcolm's mother is the product of rape. If you remember this here and stuff, his grandfather, Malcolm's actual father, was a white man who had raped his grandmother and gave birth to. So this is a woman in many ways lives up, and we use this narrative a lot back then in literature as well in life. His mother in many ways was the tragic mulatto. Now, and so I can never discern, as you had asked, Marjorie, you know, did she actually have mental illness, or was it just the confluence of life that she had?
She was overwhelmed.
That's right, just totally overwhelmed.
And her husband murdered, you know. But
right.
You know, one of the things I thought that was so, he talks a lot about white women coming to dance a Lindy Hop with black men. And he was apparently a Lindy Hop champion, and he had the Sophia girlfriend that married somebody else, white woman, continued to come to New York to visit him when her husband was out of town.
Yeah.
And he was pretty nasty to her. He's a misogynist. We have to talk about that.
Oh, my God.
I wouldn't mind getting to that, actually.
He slapped around, as he put it, this woman, Sophia. He almost never mentioned his long-suffering wife in the entire book.
But one thing Laura, who we say he pimped out in many ways,
absolutely. And whose tragedy, he takes responsibility. I mean, it's a genuine tragedy, shall we say, not an isolated one.
And truth be told, his marriage with Betty Shabazz wasn't all that either. And she did what was really prescribed of her, you know, in terms of what the Nation of Islam wanted, to multiply and very much be fruitful. She didn't actually thrive, unfortunately, until basically he had died.
Well, he calls her on the telephone to propose marriage. He hardly even knows her. He said two words to her, and she says yes, and they get married. But I want to talk a second about the part of the Roxbury Park, because I found this fascinating. He was talking about the hill Negroes in Roxbury versus the down under Negroes in Roxbury. And he talked about how there was a section of Roxbury, there was a class system on Womback and Humboldt Avenue there, and he talked about how there'd be people that would say, black people would say, I'm in banking, when in fact he'd say, they're not in banking, they're janitors, or I'm in securities. And they said, yeah, actually, you're a messenger at the security place, or I work for an old family. He talked about them, and he was pretty young this time, 15, 16, how they were brainwashed, how they were, like, just...
The class stratification.
The class stratification.
But, his sister is sort of uphill. She's
right.
In the upper class.
That's right.
But he's actually kind of participating with Shorty and the kind of the hoods.
Right. But he shows a number of stratifications. So clearly we see the class stratification. And that same stratification we also see in Harlem, Sugar Hill, you know, versus, you know, the rest of the people up in Harlem here. But Malcolm also makes it a point in terms of the colorism. Certainly that was very, very prominent at that time. And certainly someone like him could pass what we would call the brown paper test here. I wouldn't pass it, and neither would Michelle Obama. So that wouldn't get us entry into certain places.
Lighter versus darker.
Right. So I wanted to say that's why in many of the places, like even in white schools, he thrived much better because he was a light-skinned black as opposed to a dark-skinned black here.
But the other thing you can't get from this book is that he must have had, well, people say it, incredible charm and incredible command of the room and the big brain we talked about, because he knew everybody. He's at Roseland. He's hanging around with Johnny Hodges, the great musician. Count Basie's band is there. He knows the band members. He knew Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, he becomes a big star in Roseland. He becomes a big star when he moves to Harlem. And what is he at this point, like 19 or 20? He's really young.
But, you know, I think one of the things that is kind of lost in the narrative, and I think that a lot of scholars have looked more closely into, is really the impact that his father had on him. His father was a Garveyite, which is really a central. And Garvey really brings to us those sort of early notions of Afrocentricity.
And Marcus Garvey.
And Marcus Garvey. Absolutely here. His father was a Baptist preacher. He was a PK son. You kind of just through osmosis, you know, learn that sort of oratorical skill and that whole notion of let me know who my community is, or let me learn how to address whoever it is that I'm talking to. So I'm not surprised, you know, that he was able to do that.
Well,
equally, I just want to say, as MLK, who was weaned definitely through his life to do so.
Okay, so we should get to the
I want to get to the middle.
Prison part and then his activism and part of the nation business. We only have like 13 minutes left here to go. So he goes to prison, basically. He starts reading the
aardvark
and absorbs everything with this encyclopedic memory. He's reading philosophy, he's reading Nietzsche, he's reading all these people.
Sartre, yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And he sends a letter to Elijah Muhammad because his brother has been turned on to the Black Muslim movement. But this is where I think I'd like to ask you to draw the connection or draw the line between Garveyism and what Elijah Muhammad is preaching at the time, because this kind of advanced middle section of Malcolm X's life is about the separation of the races, right? That the African American race can only thrive completely, you know, completely independent of white people, that integration is kind of a hoax. There's even, as you know, there's some kind of very vaguely ugly anti-Semitic overlay thrown in there. But what is the line, the through line, if there is one, between Garveyism and Elijah Muhammad's teaching?
Quite a bit. I mean, first of all, Garvey has a body of work, and I don't know if you're familiar with it. And so you have, even today, a lot of Garvey scholars here and stuff. So he very much had this back to Africa movement. He had the Star Line. He actually had these ships that would actually take us back. He is in the early 1900s, and I just need to say, he is in dialogue with W.E.D. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. And as you know, in 1915, Booker T. drops out of the scene here. He was very much about a different form of what we call Black self-reliance here. We got to understand that the American Colonization Society also had something similar, that African Americans would not thrive here. And so my point is that the difference between Garvey and Elijah is that Garvey really was a scholar. Elijah wanted to do what Garvey...
He's a leader and a teacher.
Right.
And
a philosopher.
And he was able to write to this guy from prison.
But wasn't Elijah in prison, too? Because wasn't he a draft dodger?
I think he was in prison.
Right,
I think he was in prison, too. But Malcolm X was writing to him from prison, getting letters back and forth. And he became, correct me if I'm wrong, to me it seemed like almost a second father figure to him.
That's right, adopted father.
Yes,
right.
And then when he was out of prison, he evangelized for the Nation of Islam, and I think there were 400 people.
Right, and went up to 25,000.
I think it was 40, wasn't it? 40,000 or something.
You might
like
be
that?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
it becomes perceived as a very large movement, and largely thanks, I guess, to Malcolm's incredible powers.
Evangelical preaching as an orator, and
it becomes a threat, because this is what happens. He didn't trust Haley. This is how Haley gets on the scene, because what had happened?
Who wrote the book?
Yeah. Absolutely, it was growing, and people wanted to know. Well, what's happening here? What is this? Because he was preaching anti-Christianity. Okay, everybody black was Christian back in that day and stuff. And here was something that was just growing
quickly. Well, and he's anti-MLK, right? Which is sort of inconvenient for the white story of like how everything's getting better, and it's getting better thanks to this
blue-eyed devils, Irene. I didn't want to get offended by that. I was a blue-eyed devil for much of the book, but then he changed his mind.
Well, I think you know, it's very, very interesting. I think I took that also, and I know that white people take that as an offense here, but I took that more as a statement about the iconic image of Jesus, that we as African Americans were very much bowing down to this particular image. Why do we have such a God that don't look like us? As a matter of fact, it is the Nation of Islam that are the first to preach a black theology. It doesn't get picked up by people like myself, who's in the Christian tradition, until at least two decades later. The first time we hear that God could even possibly be black was from the Nation of Islam.
Well, he certainly wasn't blue-eyed and blonde.
Coming from the Middle East.
Yeah,
we kind of understand that. Yeah.
So let's move on from prison now. So he's out of prison. He
has a transformation in prison.
That's right. Oh, well, explain that.
No, I mean, I think what happens here, I think one of the things he learns is that the best thing one can do with your time, and the best enemy of really in terms of going out of prison, is to be educated. But he had a hungry mind. I mean, not
right. I mean, ironically, ironically, he was like a star in seventh grade.
Right.
In a good school, et cetera, et cetera. But he hadn't been educated since then.
But it's the prison. Another thing, prison was very different. He went to two different difference. The one that he first went to,
the Charleston Jail.
That one was really about rehabilitating people. It had a library. It had all. I mean, he could take classes. Very, very different than it being the second one he went to was just really doing hard time.
Yeah.
So that had a lot to do with it too.
I should interject a social note. I mean, Norfolk, what you're referring to, was a sort of an experimental facility. Literally, when Malcolm showed up there, and it was not overcrowded as it is now. And it had this library, which I don't believe exists anymore.
That's right.
And he points out that scholars, academics from Harvard and BU used to debate teams. And they still do.
That's right. Oh.
Because the
really?
New Yorker, yeah, yeah. Did a story just
That's
fairly
right,
recently.
Right, that, right. So one of the things I wanted to just say that you can rehab people if that is your intent. That if we can spend more money rehabbing as opposed to the prison, you know, the school to prison pipeline, you know, we could have a different kind of person coming out here. But he learned his debating skills in prison.
That's right.
That's right.
And became
That's
an incredible... By the way, I should mention, with the dreaded local angle, he was also a Parker House busboy, and he was on the Jerry Williams radio show when he was proselytizing for the Nation of Islam. So let's talk about the Nation of Islam and how he created this movement of very powerful people.
And also, I keep asking, because I'm genuinely curious, another amazing thing in the book, of course, is his... And it's hard for someone like me... sort of tired, played out white guy, is his pivot from the Nation of Islam to quote-unquote real Islam. And it's
Sunni.
A huge... The Mecca chapter in the book is... And the reason he moves away from his father, as we've described, his father, Elijah Muhammad, is turns out to be sort of for two reasons. Elijah's jealous of Malcolm's charismatic... preaching and his growing following.
Because he's on everywhere. He's on ABC News.
But also the folks in the Nation of Islam are growing too. But what happens is, if you remember, JFK is assassinated. And then what happens, he says that the chickens have come home to roost.
After Elijah said to him not to comment.
That's right. Yeah. And what happened with that people don't talk about, and we can look back at it now, is that it became suspect in a way. It was bringing attention in a way that Elijah Muhammad didn't want it. We can now talk about COINTELPRO, but we certainly didn't know about it then.
Well,
mention another divisive point between is that he came to disapprove of Elijah Muhammad's personal ethics.
Right, because he had impregnated a few of his secretaries.
But he used that. I mean, I think, absolutely. But I think what the thing is like, that was kind of like an open secret. You know what I mean? So a lot of scholars will look back and look at that he used that as a springboard to catapult himself more on a national stage because he had been for so long the spokesperson for the Nation of Islam.
Okay, we got 5 minutes left here, so I want to talk about big picture. Talk about the Nation of Islam and the United States of America and civil rights, because there was a schism, obviously, between MLK, we're gonna march down the streets in Selma, and we're gonna be abused and all that, and his attitude, as Ossie Davis said, he was a man, he didn't want to have to be lying down to get beat by everybody. It's a different philosophy.
Again, we look back at that. I always say that we needed them both, as we say back, and then the terminology was Negro, so good Negro versus bad Negro here and stuff. But one of the things that few little short moment when they actually meet up, he realizes, I mean, he's transforming in so many ways, that they both have the ultimate goal here. I mean, his idea was very much about being a segregationist, and King was very much about, you know, an integrationist, that the only way to raise the moral, you know, high ground of this nation, of this entire nation, is to integrate it.
One little anecdote, when he sat next to Coretta King down in Selma when MLK was in jail, he apparently said to her that it might be easier for whites to accept MLK compared to me, this angry, tall, scary-looking black guy, you know, and I thought that was, I guess he was serious, but in some ways...
But it's a joke, though, because one of the things we understand is that King was also hated and also was dangerous, you know, so that becomes a problem here, too, you know, and it, interestingly, they both are assassinated, they both die at 39, I mean, really, so their lives are more similar than apart, but absolutely, at the time, Malcolm scared black people.
Yeah, and there was Thurgood Marshall had no use for the Nation of Islam.
Absolutely,
the first African American Supreme Court justice. So let's get to the toward the end of his life when he began to believe.
Well, this gets very complicated and very interesting and very controversial. I mean, when he goes to Mecca, at least again according to the autobiography, is when he first starts to perceive, for instance, that it is, to use current terminology, that Islam is an extremely diverse faith, and that there are good white, like Northern Africans, they're sort of good white people because they are Islamic.
And they're at Mecca.
Thus, they're good. So then, again, relying on this account, you know, then he comes back to America and has a change of heart, or does he, you know, about white people? He does some sort of lip service. He's more open to the Martin Luther King solutions, et cetera, et cetera. But there's some doubt as to how much that's interpolated into his life by Haley to make him more palatable. I read a long article in The New Yorker suggesting that maybe he just was more confused than anything at the end of his life.
See, that's interesting. I don't think he was confused here. I think he actually was growing. Now, think what we didn't have was a kumbaya moment. Did once he realized that, you know what, I need to stop demonizing all white people, that we could have white allies. I think he began to even see that, because the way he began to see it anew was by making that trip to Mecca and seeing white people there, and then realizing that there were white people getting on those buses going down to the south. So that was really the transformation here. Malcolm was never confused. I mean,
let's be fair, his life is cut short.
So yeah, he was 40.
We're sort of saying
39,
this, 39, we're saying the
like,
same
like,
thing.
Like Martin.
He never had time to elaborate or, you know, on this particular phase of where he was going.
But he had a movement. See, you think of where we were at 39, okay? I'm still thinking of where I am now. But the both of them were saddled, whether they want to or not. They were saddled with a movement in a time that, and even today, we still don't have an anti-lynching law. I mean, really, we still, no matter, although we don't see the water fountains and the bathrooms, we're still living in a post-Jim Crow America. These were young men who could not have imagined dying for this kind of cause. And unfortunately, we see black men who die even younger in the streets of America, you know.
Okay, 10 seconds, wrap it up.
We're done, right?
Unfortunately.
We haven't even got to the assassination yet.
No,
we haven't gotten to Alex Haley or Ozzie Davis, but I'll tell you something. Everybody should read this.
Yeah.
It is an amazing book, is it not?
Yeah. And it's like St. Augustine's Confession. It's a spiritual journey.
It's a spiritual journey. That's right. Do you have anything you want to say?
That's a great read. No.
Okay. All right. Very good. I'm sorry we didn't get to any of the phone calls. My apology. It was Irene's fault.
We found
Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston Globe's voice, the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book, The Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the End of a Beautiful Friendship. Coming up, Tom Brady can beat time, but can he beat the latest scandal to plague the New England Patriots for opening the lines, asking you if Bob Kraft has sullied the Patriots' way? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our studio at the Boston Public Library. And guess what? Jim Browdy has shown up. He's here for the next segment. This is Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If anything could take the bloom off the Patriots' historic six, is it the knowledge that hours before the Pats won the AFC Championship game, Robert Kraft was paying for sex acts at the Orchids of Asia Spa in Jupiter, Florida. At noon, we're opening the lines asking you if this dulls the Patriots' luster. Then Attorney General Moore Healey joins us for this month's edition of Ask the AG. We'll ask her if Massachusetts will join other states to block President Trump's national emergency declaration, and we'll open the line so she can field your questions and calls. Then CNN's John King gives us the latest on the 2020 race, fresh from the Corn Belt, where he's been taking the pulse of Iowa voters. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We'll be right back.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy has finally shown up. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
So despite you mocking me for my late appearance, let me just say I was listening in the car as I was driving in to the three of you. That was one incredibly interesting conversation.
Wasn't it interesting? We're thinking about part two.
What does that mean?
We didn't get
through.
Oh, I
know you didn't.
I know.
In any case, it's good to be here. Thanks for the warm welcome, Marjorie.
You're welcome.
In this 2018 interview with CNBC, Patriots owner Robert Kraft describes his pregame ritual.
I've had a ritual for the whole time that Tommy's been playing where I see him right at his locker before the game, and we have a little chat. And I can usually look in his eyes and see how we're going to do.
Thanks to a police investigation into human trafficking, you know all about it, we now know he may have another pregame ritual. According to court documents, hours before the Patriots won the AFC Championship game, Kraft was paying for sex acts at the Orchids of Asia Spa in Jupiter, Florida. According to those documents released by the Palm Beach State's Attorney's Office, it was the second visit by Robert Kraft made to the massage parlor in less than 24 hours. And I'm guessing this is not part of the TB12 regimen. Regardless, yesterday Robert Kraft was officially charged with two counts of first-degree solicitation. We're opening the lines and asking you, if Deflategate didn't hurt the Patriots, if the team's cozy relationship, at least its leaders with Trump, didn't take away their sheen, if CTE and what it did to Aaron Hernandez didn't dampen your enthusiasm for the Pats, is this the thing that could, or is your conclusion this is a matter between Robert Kraft and the authorities in Jupiter, Florida? The number is 877-301-8970. Can I add to something I said the other day to
you? Sure.
I think Kraft has such incredibly huge political and personal capital here that if instead of that stupid lawyer's comment that he did nothing illegal, we'll have no further comment because it's a legal proceeding, if he stood up, did a press conference, and said, listen, I can't believe I did this. I regret it. It will never happen again. I've dedicated my life to exactly the opposite of this, non-exploitation. I'm sorry. I will double down and dedicate it more. That would have been a step. And I have to say also, this is a guy whose public relations skills are about 1,000 times better than mine. Hiring the same lawyer yesterday who represented Epstein, who is this serial pedophile rapist in Florida who got off only because Trump's current Secretary of Labor was the U.S. attorney, and we learned a few days ago, totally broke all the rules to allow Epstein to get off, was a move of epic poor judgment, at least in my estimation. But I don't think it's too late for him before this April court date, for which he doesn't even need to appear, to say, listen, horrible mistake, I regret it. It's not going to happen again. And I think it's a pretty forgiving public for a guy who's led a pretty exemplary kind of existence.
Well, we'll see. Joan Vernacchi had an interesting column in the Globe today saying that Me Too has changed everything. And for Kraft and people like him, the shock is getting caught and getting named. We used to just go after the prostitutes, and these are not exactly prostitutes. We know these are sex traffickers, and in this case came from China and didn't speak English, and were basically prisoners in that spa down there, but that we used to arrest just the prostitutes and kind of ignore the Johns, and that thinking has changed about this. We're going to talk to the Attorney General in a little bit about her work on sex trafficking.
Who's worked closely with Robert Kraft on a whole variety of initiatives.
And Eric McLeish, who represented a lot of the children in the Catholic sex abuse case, he thinks that we are, that these allegations against Kraft are a very big deal, and they are still allegations, as we know, will be in court April 24th. But he thinks that people who do what he does have no excuse for saying they didn't know that this was a sex trafficking situation, just as you have no excuse if you are a grown man who's having sex with an underage woman, and you say, well, I didn't know she was only 15. You don't have an excuse. You're charged with statutory rape. He wants to charge these people with a felony. As it is, they've upped the charges a little bit on Kraft from second degree to first degree misdemeanor. But no one is talking, as I know, about a felony, but we'll talk to the Attorney General about that, too.
Well, you know, I don't disagree with McLeish's conclusion. What I do is, I guess, when you're 77 years old and you have no record of similar sorts of things, if you did it, you got to own up to it. And again, there are a lot of people who couldn't, I don't mean to use the term get away, which is about to do, but couldn't survive something this relatively whole. It's embarrassing, obviously. But I think Kraft, if he took the right course and decided not to fight this, as his hiring of a lawyer suggests he may, I think could come out of this relatively well, despite the embarrassment. But there's no sign so far that that's happening. What is sign is he's lawyered up, and we'll see what happens.
No, I think you're right. You do the sincere apology. You're going to make amends. You're going to donate a lot of money. You're going to...
You talked about that woman. Is it Brandeis the other day, the professor?
Professor.
Funding...
Yeah, he's funding is someone whose prime academic area is sex trafficking, and she's funded by the Myra and Robert Kraft Chair, in addition to one of the Hyatt family. And of course, Myra Kraft was
Hyatt,
her maiden name was a Hyatt. But you know, you supposedly, if you do get convicted of this thing, you have to do community service, and you have to take a class on trafficking. So, I mean, he could do something if he is, and we don't know if he will be, but. He could do something very magnanimous in that regard, too. So I think it's very possible. And you saw a lot of Patriots fans interviewed on television last night and in the paper. And there was very funny thing on Trevor Noah's show where all these past fans saying, what the hell? You know, come on. I mean, it's fine. We don't care. I mean, you know, he's an older man. He's lost his wife. He had a girlfriend for a while. I don't know what the status is of the girlfriend. I think people are forgiving. But... on the other hand, you have much greater awareness of this kind of thing now.
Of course.
I'd never heard of sex trafficking 10 years ago.
Well, you know, a couple of... and by the way, Martha Coakley and her successor, who worked for her, Mara Healy, as you said, have been great on this. We'll talk about what her initiatives are. You know, one of the things you don't do that I would suggest you do, even though it may affect your blood pressure... I listened to sports radio for about 30 minutes last night.
Oh, yeah, what'd they say?
Well, first of all, the hosts, I would argue, last night were... if there were a list of the dumbest people on the planet, I would say they'd be in the top three. Everything I turn to, it can be both things. We can be deeply concerned about the human trafficking thing and say a price has got to be paid. At the same point, that assuming that Kraft is guilty, he says he's not, and he is willing to own up to it in a sincere kind of way, both things can... be addressed. There is blind loyalty to this guy and total ignoring of the consequences for these women amongst these sports yahoos that is really embarrassing.
Always talking about how demeaning they are on sports radio.
Not all,
in
not all. Some are. You want to take some calls?
877-301-8970. Before we take these calls, we should say that what is alleged to have happened at this at place, and this woman that ran this place down in Florida was arrested up in Massachusetts.
I heard
too.
An Oxford connection.
Yeah, we're talking about women that came here from China or South Korea thinking they were going to come here and get jobs and go to college, and they wind up in this horrible situation where they're trapped, sleeping there, cooking there in hot plates in the in the back of the spa, and performing sex acts on men between 8 and 15 times a day. So this is a hell that they're living in, and so that changes things too, I think. To a certain degree.
I totally agree. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Tony and Wareham. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I've been kind of looking at this. I don't know, maybe from a different perspective. It's horrible what went on. But what shocks me is the support he gets. I can't imagine. To me, this is the revelation of the subconscious racism in this country. Imagine if that was a black football player. Or especially imagine if it was, say, Colin Kaepernick that was found in this institution. I think there would be a whole different condemnation.
Well,
yeah, that's
I have
an interesting point.
Maybe it's an interesting point, but I think I hadn't thought about that much at all, Tony. I would say it's more about star worship than it is about race, even though you're right, the Kaepernick thing would be a whole different... But look at Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant was credibly accused of something far more serious than what Kraft is accused of, and he got standing ovations in his final year playing for the Lakers like he was some god kind of thing. But the Kaepernick point is obviously a good one. But I think
I don't know if the Kobe Bryant thing is far worse.
Why?
Because of the situation these women are in. This is,
maybe.
This is, I mean, Bob Kraft is not a dope. He had to know. He paid cash when he went in. He gave cash to these women. He went
back there at least twice,
as far as we know. What kind of operation did he think it was?
By the way, I'm surely not defending it in the slightest. I'm just saying, and Tony makes a good point. Tony may be right that if the person accused here was black, that there would not be the same level of support. I would argue, Tony, if that black person who was accused of this was a star running back for the New England Patriots, that he or she would be responded to in virtually the same way that Pats fans are responding here. Tony, thanks for the call. And by the way, I have to say, while I was criticizing some of the hosts, I've heard calls from on news and on sports stations who are totally grown up about this. You can respect all the things that Kraft has done and condemn what the authorities are accusing him of doing here. They're not, you know, those aren't mutually exclusive.
John just sent an email, John from Gardner. He said on last night's Daily Show, they did a bit on sexual predators, and there's so many now. We got the Catholic Church, we got R. Kelly, we got the Epstein, the guy down in Florida that you talked about that was involved with young girls, and of course, you know, Bill Cosby, Bill O'Reilly, you know, Roger Ailes goes on and on.
We're going to mention the church to Maura Healey in about 15 minutes. Did you read the story about this Cardinal Pell?
Yeah.
Who was convicted in December. Disgusting. In Australia. We didn't know about it till yesterday. Essentially, the grossest kind of sexual misconduct against two choir boys, not in the 1960s, which is still, but in the 1990s, a senior advisor on financial affairs to the Pope. I mean, it is just, it's literally every single day there is another story.
When you think about these things, sometimes I think that people who do this don't think of their victims as human beings, whether they're children or whether they're women in a spa, or they just don't think of them in this. Because it's almost like, how could you do these things?
You know, Tony, the first caller, we'll get to more calls in about 30 seconds, was saying, what if Kraft were black? There wouldn't be the level of support. I would argue that what the Pope has overseen in the Catholic Church, I hope you agree with this one, is exponentially worse than what Kraft did. And the volume is colossal.
Absolutely.
Most people say the Pope is doing the best he can. He's done wonderful things. And I would say every single wonderful thing this Pope has done on poor people, on immigration, is completely voided by the fact that he has presided over the most grotesque ring of pedophilia and sexual violence maybe in the history of the world.
I think our buddy Ann Barrett Doyle from Bishop's Accountability had it absolutely right.
What'd she say?
She said, they can't do it.
They cannot
police themselves. The secular authorities, the prosecutors, attorney generals need to come in and clean up this mess, because it is absolutely clear after almost 20 years of this that the Catholic Church can't police itself.
By the way, our colleagues, Philip Martin and Jennifer McKim, I assume you guys know this, did a series in January about parlors not unlike the Florida one in Massachusetts. If you want to check it out, you go to WGBHnews.org. Let's go to Colette in Plymouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling, Colette. Hi.
Hi there. I just get so into what you're saying because I love everything you're saying. All the perspectives that you're sharing really opened my mind to it. Because my first take is, you asked, does this reflect badly on the Patriots? I don't think so. I mean, I enjoy the guys. I love what they do. And it's a game, and yes, it's political, and yes, people are in administrative positions. I get it. But I think this is shame on him. If he's been a very positive role model, and he's been very supportive in society with helping to bring different issues to the forefront, you know, that's one thing. It's the hypocrisy of, okay, now is he a negative role model? Time will tell when he hits the courts and all this comes out. But, you know, I mean, if it comes down to it, it's one more mighty fall and it's one more cautionary tale. And, yes, I think getting this issue out and discussed, this is imperative. What you're doing is imperative.
Colette, thank you for a very fine call. We appreciate it.
You know, one of these stories I read pointed out that when this Indianapolis Colts owner pled guilty to a driving under a DUI.
Is that a hearsay?
What?
What's his name? Irsay? Is that who that
I think
goes?
So. I forget what his name is. He was suspended for 6 games and fined $500,000. So the NFL will probably do something about this. You just mentioned, Jim, Philip Martin and Jennifer McKim's stories about sex trafficking. And Philip's story, he points out that on any given day in Massachusetts, and this was just done this spring, 9,000 searches in the Boston area on interstate, on internet sites for places to buy sex. That goes on an average day. But I thought this was particularly interesting. The largest percentage of purchasers, the people looking for sex, are white men with postgraduate degrees making more than $100,000 a year. And a lot of them are doing this, searching for these sexual hookups, whatever you want to call them, on their computers at work. And sometimes they run out at lunch. And that was what the other interesting thing I thought.
Run out at lunch and what? Go to one of these
go
places?
Go to one of these places. Oh. And when the police were tracking Kraft, they said that the second time, this is according to the police, he was only in this place for 15 minutes. Hmm. He showed up at 11 and left at 11:15.
You know, by the way, can I say something in response to either what you read or something? When I asked these questions about the Patriots, I was hoping the answer would be, this has nothing.
Yeah.
This is about him and
about
sex
him.
Trafficking. I shouldn't have even posed that
well,
way.
Well, it's one other way for people to make fun of the Patriots that hate the
but
Patriots.
But it has nothing
you know?
To do with, it's a man who exercised some really poor judgment for which he's got to be held accountable. And I hope he knows that too. I have virtually, literally, you and I met him at an event a couple of months ago where he was also,
he was very gracious.
Very great and very generous at this mm-hmm. event for an incredibly important cause as well. So he's got to continue in this tradition. And I'm not minimizing anything. I'm just saying he's one of the few people who could be caught in this kind of situation who could make something good, not to undo what happened, out of something really bad.
Nicole from Boston. Hi, Nicole.
Hello, Nicole.
Hi, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you
for having me.
Thank you.
So my comment would be, I wonder if people won't have an issue with this because people don't necessarily have an issue with the idea of buying sex. So it's something that people do in a lot of different aspects of their life, whether it's going to strip clubs or watching porn or soliciting sex services. And while I know there was trafficking involved in this, Robert Kraft was not charged for that. Robert Kraft was charged for soliciting prostitution, something that a lot of people, including sex workers and trafficking victims, think should be decriminalized. Right? So the idea that, and I don't love Robert Kraft. I have no love for him, but in an ideal world, I think that what he did wouldn't have been a crime. Unless he knew that those women were trafficked, then I think that should be a crime.
Well, by the way, it would be a crime even if it were legal, if the women who were engaged in the, quote, legal activity were being trafficked. So, right?
Prostitution is a crime.
No, but Nicole is saying if we had Nevada laws in 49 other states, and there are a lot of people I know who support that. There are a lot of people who think it's a horrible idea. I mean, the whole idea, we grew up with a notion, you talked about things have changed, Nicole, thanks for the call, about how this was a victimless crime. And it was a victimless crime until we all learned about sex trafficking. I mean, thanks to the Coakleys and the Healys and others who have been, which preceded the whole Me Too thing, at least the high-profile Me Too thing.
And we're also learning that watching pornography is hurting people, hurting women, exploiting women. We learn that it's hurting young people growing up watching this kind of stuff, whether they're young boys or young women. I think prostitution is definitely hurting people. It's hurting these women, many of whom are drug addicted or are in desperate situations. I mean, in a perfect world, this wouldn't go on at all.
Juanita, you're in Framingham. You're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hey.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I just wanted to make the connection between the NFL kind of always looking the other way when there are kind of crimes against women, particularly domestic violence cases where players come under scrutiny, but they survive just fine. The NFL does not take action against them. And also the draw, the media draw that has come up the past several years around the Super Bowl, that there is so much sex trafficking that happens that it's part of the culture. It's part of accepted culture within the NFL.
When you say sex trafficking in the Super Bowl, you mean during Super Bowl week in the host city, or you mean what did you mean by that? That is what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. Juanita, thank you for the call. The NFL is a disgrace. Whether it's CTE or, with the exception, I'm sure I'm missing one, but Ray Rice, Why did they take strong action against Rice? One, because he was reaching the end of his career. And two, because when you have when a strong young man is punching his then-fiance, now wife, in the face, it's hard even for the clueless souls like Roger Goodell. But the numbers of cases where they've done, you know, Tom Brady allegedly deflates a ball, and a serious penalty for his team and him. Players are punching out people. And worse, and they seem not to care. It's all about the bottom line. In any case, 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Charlie in Needham. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Mark and Jim. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
I had a question. Does anyone know how long the authorities had the cameras going at this location in Florida? The reason I ask is that this state attorney seems awfully slick, Harvard-educated, Harvard Law School, and it seems as though they clearly had the ability to shut this down a long time ago, but decided to keep fishing for political expediency. He's made a big splash in the press, obviously.
You mean that they waited until they got Kraft because he's obviously the big fish you're talking about? Is that your point?
Not necessarily Kraft, but more people. I mean, the fact that they had a camera in there for more than a day seems extraordinary. These people were forced to do sex acts. Could you, Marjorie or Jim, let them go on performing these acts?
Well, I don't know anything about the prosecutor. I have to say, two Harvard degrees, in my mind, doesn't necessarily mean you're a sleazy kind of prosecutor. Some double Harvards have done pretty
very
well in life.
Sleazy over there in Cambridge, you know that.
But, there are a lot of prosecutions, I'm sure you've seen this, that have gone on for a long period of time because legitimate law enforcement people are trying to make the best case that they guarantee if they have to go in front of a jury that they can prove. So until there's objective evidence otherwise, Charlie, to suggest that he abused his discretion down there, I'll reserve judgment. But thank you for the call.
I'm dying to find out how they get these cameras in there.
Well, they have these sneak and peek warrants.
Yeah.
It's apparently a lot easier. I don't know. We can ask Mara Healy about
this. Yeah, if you just sneak in.
To get a warrant.
If you sneak in as a John and you sneak the camera in there?
Well, you got a warrant. There's some sort of warrant. It's a sneak and peek warrant. I don't even know what the term means.
Yeah, I don't
either.
Maybe
she does.
Because you'd think if you had a sneak and peek warrant and they knew you had a camera in there, they wouldn't be having people in there.
Do you believe
you think?
We're just blithely using the expression sneak and peek warrant? First of all, how gross it is. Secondly, we have no idea what it means.
I don't know.
We're just throwing it around.
Yeah.
Like,
I hope that those videos do not come to light. I hope we don't have to see them.
Well, I'm assuming that's another reason. I hope if he is guilty, if he is guilty and if he decides to own up to this early on, part of the reason may be he doesn't want the videos ever to see the light of day. But I think if there's an apology, it's sincere, depending upon what's attached to it. I think the vast majority of people are going to say, well, it doesn't undo what you did.
Yeah, he's got a lot of goodwill. I mean, I think he's got a lot of goodwill.
As he should, by the way.
He's been a great owner of the Patriots. And, you know, he's been
a
wonderful philanthropist.
He's a great member of the community, exactly.
Yeah, his wife was a wonderful philanthropist. But it's going to be interesting to see. A lot of people are put in very difficult situations that, you know, do a lot of work with sex trafficking and all that kind of stuff. And you wonder whether they'll be, if he doesn't take the route you're talking about, whether the Myra and Robert Kraft chair will just become the Myra chair and it won't be the Robert Kraft chair. But you're right. I think he's got an opportunity to really come out of this chastened but okay.
Chastened but okay, and also with an incredible platform. I mean, I would guess virtually everybody, every man, and that's who's critical here, virtually every man in America knows who Robert Kraft is. Would you not agree?
Yeah.
And as a result, if it turns out he showed some regret, atonement, whatever it is, I think the impact of this could be pretty huge.
Also, by what we've learned from these stories, is that tens of thousands of white men making over $100,000 with postgraduate degrees appear to be doing the same thing. So there's a lot of people that are going to have great empathy for them. You want to make a comment, Jim?
No, I surely do not. 877-301-8970. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by Attorney General Healy, who will take our questions and yours. And obviously, we're going to talk to her about something I know matters a lot to her, this human trafficking thing that, again, she and her predecessor have been real standouts about.
Nancy from Dedham. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So first of all, I think that just because you give your money to charity and you have a marriage for 50 years, it doesn't mean that you're a good person. You may well have been doing this for years of marriage.
You know, Nancy, you got it. Your phone is atrocious.
Yeah,
can you try to stay in one? No, don't. I want to hear. Try one more time. You're saying that essentially, just because you give money to charity, you've been married for decades to his late wife, and you have a winning team or whatever, doesn't mean you're a great person. I just have to say, with the exception of people making jokes about his ego, which doesn't bother me in the slightest. Occasionally, Dan Shaughnessy does that in his great columns in the Boston Globe. I don't think I've ever heard anything bad about Kraft. So you're right. It does those outward manifestations of good behavior don't say everything about a man or a woman, but everything I've heard about the man has been positive until this thing of several days ago, Nancy. I think we lost her. Sorry, Nancy. Thank you much for the call. And again, it was the connection. It was not obviously not the content of what you had to say. 877-301-8970.
Tom from Cambridge, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I only need about 30 seconds. First of all, I think it's largely irrelevant to me about the good or bad impacts on Robert Kraft, the Patriots, or football. What I care about is the victims of sex trafficking and the new slavery. And if it's a good thing that this has happened, if it promotes awareness and leads to action, I'm glad that these women are going to have hopefully a better life now. I'm a historian of slavery, and for years I've assigned a book by Kevin Bales, Disposable People, to my students at a business college. And it's an epiphany for many of them, and I can't recommend this book enough. It's mostly about the whole world, not just the U.S., but it'll be an eye-opening experience. Disposable People. Thank
and what's
you
the guy?
Much.
Wait, don't go away. What's the guy's name one more time? The author?
Kevin Bales, B-A-L-E-S.
Tom, the thesis, I assume, is that we consider some people disposable, and therefore we can do what we want to them?
The thesis is that the new global economy makes more people vulnerable and has led to a renaissance of slavery, even though it's illegal everywhere.
Okay.
Tom, thanks for the
thank
call.
Thank you very much. I had not heard of that book before. Chuck in New Bedford. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, Chuck.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Well, I just wanted to touch on the irony between, you know, Trump using the argument for the wall about slavery and Kraft's support of Trump. I'm just wondering, you know, how this, what we won't see is Trump using Kraft's involvement here, using, you know, employing this slavery. Is he going to, I'm not sure if I'm being clear on this, but the point is it's an unusual irony this is happening, that the Kraft supporter is actually guilty. I mean, the Trump supporter is actually someone that actually is a slavery employee.
I'm not sure I got that one. We got to go, though, because the Attorney General has just arrived. Thank you,
Chuck.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. We do have to go, as Jim just said, because the Attorney General is here. Up next, we're going to talk to Attorney General Maura Healey. She's here to take our questions and your calls next on 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She is Marjorie Egan. We are broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We're now joined by Attorney General Maura Healey. The Attorney General is here for, obviously, Ask the Attorney General, taking our questions and yours. You can tweet her at BOS Public Radio, send her an email to bpr@wgbh.org, or the best route is 877-301-8970. Attorney General, it's nice to see you.
Hey, good to be with you both.
Great to talk to you, too, Attorney General Healey. You know, we were just talking to our listeners about Robert Kraft, who's accused of some soliciting prostitution and sex trafficking situation, a grim situation down in Jupiter, Florida. You've done tons of work on sex trafficking, and you also work with Robert Kraft on anti-violence education programs, that game change thing. So what's your takeaway on this whole situation?
Well, obviously the allegations are deeply troubling and disturbing. The Florida authorities are investigating, and I'm confident they'll do their job. But I'll tell you, you know, human trafficking, I think one thing that this has really brought to light for a lot of people is what human trafficking is. And, you know, we know from our experience in the office, and look, I have a division of troopers and prosecutors and victim witness advocates who are out there every day. Since 2012, we've charged over 50 individuals with running human trafficking operations here in Massachusetts. We've also charged many others with sex for fee, Johns, in these cases. And it runs the gamut. Some of what we see is the massage parlor. In fact, we had a takedown recently and announced indictments a little while ago against an operation that was running out of massage parlors. We've done them in the past, including ones that involve trafficking of women from Flushing, New York, similar to what's alleged now down in Florida. We also see operations set up in people's homes, in communities, rural, urban, and suburban, all over the state, where through the internet now, it's very simple to set up essentially a brothel within a neighborhood. We certainly see any number of other instances of human trafficking. And to listen to these survivors and these girls and these women, you know, you really understand the exploitation and what's happening. Many of them present initially as people who are extremely vulnerable, whether they're individuals who are coming to this country from another country, or more often than not, they are girls or young women who may have been the victims of sexual abuse, may have been taken in by a pimp or a trafficker they met at the mall or online who pretended they wanted to be their boyfriend. We see many of our victims who are kept in what's called the life through drugs and alcohol. Many of our victims are dealing with serious drug issues. So it's terribly sad and exploitive and dehumanizing, and I think that today, this week, more people have a greater awareness of this activity, its pervasiveness, and I can tell you that as your Attorney General. This is activity that exists in Florida, it exists in Massachusetts, it exists all over this state, all over this country, and we need to do something about it. And, you know, the other thing I'd say is this. If you want to really have something that'll blow your mind, there's a study just a couple of years ago, and basically that it was a study that looked at what was happening within the Boston downtown area. And basically, coming from computer terminals in the Boston area, there were 9,000 hits a day of people going online in Boston trying to buy sex on the way home. 20,000 ads posted each month in the greater Boston area for people to go and buy sex. So this is nothing new. It's something we've been aggressive about as an office, and we'll continue to be aggressive about, and we'll continue to work hard for the victims and survivors out there to end this. But ending this, I think the model has changed from prosecuting those who are engaged and exploited in this practice to really going after the demand side of this, which I think is incredibly important. You break demand, you know, you shut down this industry.
One last thing on this, Maura Healey, if you will. When you mentioned whatever it is, 9,000 people seeking sex on the way home from their offices, didn't you do some initiative, I hope I got this right, with employers or something? Was it with Walsh, Mayor Walsh? What exactly is that? What's the goal there?
So this is about, I think it's an important partnership. We basically announced this partnership Mayor Walsh and myself and our offices with the business community to get businesses to have this on their radar, to adopt zero tolerance policies, to then get the word out to their employees that this behavior is unacceptable. Do not use company resources, computers. Do not go on business trips or to conferences and buy sex. You will be held accountable. And we had a number of businesses sign on. We hope to grow that. I think, Jim, it's important that we do that consciousness raising and change the culture around this while we do our investigations and enforcement work.
You know, I used to think that prostitution was a victimless crime. What do you think?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
But I'm not, you know, that unfortunately is a thinking that still exists in places. But I just speak from experience, having sat around the table with survivors and victims. This is not a victimless crime. At the other end, there is always somebody's mother, sister, daughter, and they don't want to be there. They don't want to be there. And if you, you know, were to put yourself, imagine oneself trapped in a motel room for days at a time, subject to 15, 20 men coming through the door each day and having to perform sex acts on them. Think about the young girls who were holed up right now, right around here in apartments or hotel rooms or the like. I mean, that is not something that reflects a willing engagement. And certainly we know from the age, which, by the way, you know, people probably don't realize, girls in Massachusetts are brought into the life, brought into human trafficking as early as 12, 13, 14 years old. And so they're not even of an age where they could even begin to engage in something willingly. This is exploitation of the most vulnerable, and it's really shameful behavior.
Can we broach one other sexual misconduct question? Well, actually, there are two others, and then we'll take calls. 877-301-8970. I'm not sure I understand this terribly well, because when I read about it, and then we talked to Shirley Young from The Globe, who editorialized about it, and then we reached out to the Gaming Commission, and they have a slightly different story. The way I read the stories in the Boston Globe is after a behind-closed-door, I think, five-hour meeting, the Gaming Commission voted to authorize their lawyers to settle the lawsuit filed by Wynn. And ultimately, whatever redacted version of this report that comes out, it's one thing for the public not to see it, which to me is outrageous. What I couldn't believe, and read it twice to make sure I was reading correctly, is even the commissioners would not see the unredacted version of the report, which means they could end up voting on the whole issue of suitability of the Wynn successor, whatever it's called, Encore, to keep the license out there in Everett without a full set of information. One, how does that strike you? And two, is there a role for your office in this issue? You're nodding in agreement. So what is it?
Yes, I think there is and will be a role for our office, though it depends on what the report ultimately says. So, you know, as background, you know, what you're alluding to, Jim.
Did I get it right, by the way?
Yeah. No, okay. And here, you know, I mean, here's the deal, right? The Gaming Commission selected Wynn. Later on, this information came to light that he was engaged in all sorts of sexual harassment and wrongdoing, and then there were real questions about whether company execs then hid that in the process of applying to our Gaming Commission to get the license. There was an investigation. It has been thorough. It has been exhaustive, in my view, though we'll see what the report has to say, but certainly they've spent time. What happened during the course of it, though, is that Wynn separately, individually, came forward and fought the disclosure of certain documents under the label that they were attorney-client privileged. Mm-hmm. So there was this fight, a real distraction, frankly, and really unfortunate, and frankly offensive to me as the Attorney General in this state, that this court in Nevada was going to somehow dictate how things were going to go here in the state. But anyhow, after a lot of legal wrangling, Jim, what ended up happening is there was a resolution. And the resolution allowed the commission to receive this report. There are apparently some documents that aren't going to be part of it. But my hope is that it will be a full and complete enough report that will give the commission all the information that it needs to be able to do this analysis.
But so, how do you... You said you'll look at the report and make a decision. Mm-hmm. But how does it... The place where I'm getting hung up is how do you as Attorney General or the Commission make an informed decision when you don't, to quote Errol Morris, or to paraphrase Errol Morris, when you don't know what you don't know. If the lawyers accede to some of the requests of Wynn's lawyers, the Gaming Commission's lawyers accede to some of the requests of Wynn's lawyers, certain things will be struck that they won't see, we won't see, and you won't see.
The investigators saw. And so the investigator's obligation was to give the commission a complete report. There may be things that may be extra that were not necessary, Jim. There may be some documents that may be extra and not necessary to give the commission that complete report. Again, I want to see what that report has to say. But I believe that was the understanding of the investigators, that they were going to proceed with making as full a report as available as possible. This involves documents that Steve Wynn individually is claiming were protected by attorney-client privilege. I want to see what the report says, and I'm going to leave our options open in terms of what should happen next. But I hope that this, I think we're going to see the report in a very short time, and we'll have a better opportunity
and you're not worried,
to assess
last
there.
Thing, and then I'm not going to belabor this thing. Are you concerned? I am concerned, but I don't know 1/100th as much about it as you do, that there's huge pressure because of the delay in resolving this on the Gaming Commission to make a decision, because this thing is scheduled to open in just a few months. Are you worried that the lawyers may agree to redact much more than would be appropriate in furtherance of this desire quickly?
I want to look at the report, but nothing to date has given me cause for concern. I feel like the investigators who are separate, they report to the commission, mm-hmm. but they work within for the commission, have undertaken a thorough review. We'll see what the report says. But no, the Gaming Commission should feel no pressure whatsoever. They need to do their job. They need to do it well and to do it right. And I don't care that a building's been built. The more important work and effort was to make sure that for this first go-round, and again, this is our first test in this new industry of a suitability analysis, that it's done well, that it's done with complete mm-hmm. information, full information in the facts, and that's what the focus should be on. The fact that this structure is built or near built should not be what drives the decision-making of the commission. The commission has an obligation and a duty to do this thoroughly and carefully, and I expect and hope that that's what they will do. But I'm looking, I'm anxious to see the report.
877-301-8970 is the number if you want to speak to the Attorney General.
Let's go to Gina in Boston. Hi, Gina.
Hello,
Thank you
Gina.
For calling.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great.
Okay, my question is, I can understand it was a misdemeanor for a first offense, but knowingly going in there and committing another offense, why is it just a misdemeanor? This is what I'm not understanding.
You're talking about the situation with Kraft in Florida, you're asking.
Yes, I am. Actually, I'm talking about any situation. Any person of intelligence would know that where he was walking into was going to be a setup of that nature.
By the way, Eric McLeish has a piece in the Globe today arguing that it should be a felony. He, of course, represented a lot of children in the Catholic Church mess.
What's your reaction to Gina there, Attorney General Healy?
Gina, I'm not going to comment on the specifics of this situation. It appears that Mr. Kraft's been charged with two misdemeanor counts based on two different incidents, and we'll see what happens as things go forward. I will add, though, one comment, though, Marjorie. You mentioned Eric McLeish's call for making this a felony. One thing that my office has proposed is to have a new law that regulates these massage parlors. Right now, if they style themselves a so-called body works operation, they're not subject to licensure requirements and inspection the way other entities are. I think that's wrong. I think that should change, and I am hopeful that the legislation we proposed earlier this year will be passed. Will it solve everything? Absolutely not, but this is one thing that I do think is important that we do.
We're talking to Attorney General Maura Healey. She's with us to almost the bottom of the next hour. If you want to talk to her directly, you call her at 877-301-8970. Speaking of sexual misconduct, Marjorie and I were talking earlier, the latest in what are almost daily outrages in the Catholic Church, this Cardinal Pell, we learned out in December, was convicted in Australia of sexually assaulting, molesting two choir boys in the 1990s. He's a chief financial advisor, as you know, of the Pope, we have broached this with you every single month. In November, Attorney General, when we asked you, you said we're actively reviewing all of this, were your words. And then you said, as I said, we've been in touch with the Archdiocese, we've been in touch with the District Attorney's offices, we're currently looking at policies, procedures, and practices right now. As you know much better than we, a bunch of Attorneys General have actually gone further, and obviously Pennsylvania being the highest profile example. What can you tell us about the status of your look into this Catholic Church mess?
Well, I think the Catholic Church once again has demonstrated that it is not able to police itself, and that is why law enforcement is involved and should be involved. And because of that, I'm limited in what I can say to you now, Jim.
Are you able to say, well, one last thing, I've asked this before, so my apologies in advance. I was a little upset the other day that the Globe, which has done beyond brilliant reporting on this since day one, stated as a fact that Cardinal O'Malley never saw the letter that was sent to him about Cardinal McCarrick, who obviously has been defrocked right before this bishop's conference. We don't know. All we know is that he said he didn't see it, and his secretary says, I never gave it to him because I didn't think it was part of the commission that he chairs a jurisdiction. Is that something you're looking into or contemplating looking into about whether Cardinal O'Malley actually knew about McCarrick and did nothing?
I think that's way too discreet, to be honest. I mean, I'm focused on the big picture here. I'm focused on what has happened in the state, what happened to victims and survivors, what happened in terms of conduct. I think that's where we've got to go in addition to, you know, bringing accountability. I mean, it's amazing what transpired last week, though unfortunately I guess not surprising, notwithstanding the hopes of many that...
You mean at the conference in the Vatican?
Yeah, it's a joke, you know? And I just... if the church wants people to go to church and join the church, then they need to change. But this is absolutely unacceptable. This stuff is law enforcement. It is secular. It should not be controlled by canons or anything else. And we have seen the abject failure, you know, from Rome on down and out, of people in power doing anything about this or even recognizing, apprehending this as wrongdoing, as bad conduct. So to me, it just gets more and more ridiculous, and I think that's why you see more of us in law enforcement involved, and we absolutely need to demand that there be change. I mean, this is completely unacceptable, and I don't know... I don't know what they're thinking, but the American bishops ought to separate off and figure it out and do what's right here under our laws, because they are all under our laws here in the state and across this country, and they need to, you know, get out of the mindset that somehow they're not subject to not even laws, Jim, right? I mean, how many of us in our workplaces, how many of us in our schools are subject to training on sexual harassment, on child abuse, on reporting to authorities, what to do, how to recognize the signs. And this is an organization and an entity that just does not subscribe to any of that. And in fact, last week is once again rejecting that. It's wrong, and they'll be held accountable.
Chris and Lynn, you're on with the Attorney General, Maura Healey. Welcome to the show. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point. I know it's not going to be a popular one, but I've heard many times it's said by the Attorney General that the viewpoint is to go after the men who are soliciting and basically deal with the women as victims and just help them instead of prosecuting them. And I just don't understand why both sides, if both people are committing a crime, why not every woman. I understand in the case where there's proof that someone's being held against their will and it's a trafficking operation, but a lot of these websites that you're saying 9,000 people a day, a lot of these websites are women who just don't have many other options, and unlike men, they have the option to sell their body, whether it's with webcams, stripping, or going into prostitution, and I just don't understand why they're not also held responsible for their actions.
Attorney General?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you look at those websites, Chris, and you know, for those who are going online and just viewing them, they may not realize that those websites many times are not created by the woman there pictured. In fact, the woman there pictured is not even the woman you're going to go meet when you show up at that motel. These are all just a ruse, and they're set up and they're designed by pimps and traffickers that are out there. The women, I can tell you, you know, from the more than from the dozens of cases that we've prosecuted here. And I want to be clear, not only have we gone after Johns, but we've gone after the human traffickers, those who are actually running these operations, men and women who are controlling the books, who are laundering the money, who are shuffling girls and women from Flushing on up here, who are grooming them here in our rural, urban, and suburban communities, who are keeping them clothed and sort of fed in places. We've gone after and prosecuted many of them, but I think that, you know, if you actually look at and understand what's going on here, you will see that the women who are out there, first of all, it's illegal to sell sex, period. It's illegal to buy sex, period. But the women who are the ones who are engaging in those sex acts are forced there through financial coercion, through drugs and alcohol, through emotional vulnerabilities. You know, again, you know, so many. I work with this great organization, My Life, My Choice.
Yes.
Right? And it's so cool to see these girls come out of what has been just horrific subjugation and degradation. I have them to my office every year, and one of the girls, I remember, you know, not too long ago when they were meeting and they're sharing their stories. And you know what they're trained to do? They're trained to be mentors for younger girls, to give them the self-esteem and empowerment so that they don't fall subject to the pimps and the traffickers that are out there. But I remember this girl, and she's, you know, we were taking a picture up by my podium where I do the press conferences and the like afterwards. And she went up, not in front of the podium with the rest of her group, but behind the podium. And the other girls are like, what are you doing? Get down here with us. And she said, no, I didn't come to just meet the boss. I came to be the boss.
Oh, God.
So to me, it's really inspiring. And it shows, you know, these are kids, these are women who've been through hell, who came into a life that, frankly, their parents probably never, you know, could have imagined. In many instances, we're not talking about poor kids either. We're talking about kids that run the socioeconomic gamut. And so I fundamentally disagree with the perspective of the caller that, you know, if you actually do any of these cases, you'll realize that these women and girls are all there through exploitation.
You know, I have a feeling we've mentioned this too before. A friend of ours and someone we've had on the show, I assume you know Mary Mazzio.
Of course, yeah.
Mary Mazzio made a great film. If people want to have all your, this is for you, Chris, and others, have all of their conventional wisdom exploded about who's involved and who's exploited. And her film is called I Am Jane Doe. I think it was shown at the White House, if I remember correctly, too. She's a former Olympian rower, a former big-time lawyer downtown, now a great filmmaker, Mary Mazzio. It's called I Am Jane Doe. Check it out. It is really, it is extraordinarily good.
And I just say to folks out there, I mean, just think about it for a minute, okay? And think about it, guys. Like, would you, is it worth it to you? I mean, there are a lot of ways to make money in this world, okay? You think these girls and women want to stand there day after day and subject themselves to 15, 20, 25 random strangers each day, day in and day out, and be forced to do and engage in all sorts of acts? Does that sound like a great way for you to make money? It's not, you know. This is what I mean. There, the notion that this is a victimless crime or career choice is just, you know, part of the culture that we've got to really change and disabuse people of.
Before we take a break, Attorney General, do you know who Roger McNamee is? Roger McNamee wrote a book called Zucked. He was with us on radio and TV yesterday. Early investor, mentor to Mark Zuckerberg a decade ago. He's now written a book talking about the catastrophe that is Facebook. In the middle of our conversation, I can't remember if it was on radio or TV, he used your name out of nowhere. And he said, by the way, we need to turn... he has great faith in Congress because of what he says, the 40 new members, 39 of whom are under 40 years old, they're going to change things on this. And I said, well, I don't have much confidence in Congress. He says, and the states have to do it. And then your name came up. Yep. Could you give us the short version of what you're doing to protect people from all these privacy violations that McNamee is running around talking about?
I mean, this is fundamentally about what's happened with all these platforms that are out there, whether it's Google or Amazon, and the extent to which they actually control the world. They've found a way to capture and aggregate information and data that really belongs to us and then monetize that. And, you know, we have seen how that has been misused and really abused by these companies. So McNamee, we know well. As folks may know, we're currently in the midst of investigating Facebook, and that work will continue. I can tell you that my colleagues and I and tend to be very aggressive here, because this is a matter of law enforcement and there needs to be accountability, and the public needs to have a assurance that as we move forward, these platforms make some serious reforms. But McNamee, I think, has been really important in bringing to light the practices and what was actually happening at a company like Facebook that led to what has really been a debacle that not only is affects our privacy, they found a way to monetize and exploit our data. We obviously know the concerns about electioneering and sort of what's happened there. And we really, I think, as a country, sure, we need national leadership. This would be a really great place for some national leadership. But in the absence of that, and I do hope that Congress acts, you'll see state AG investigation and enforcement
continue.
Are
there bills pending in our legislature? I mean, one of the things he said to us yesterday was these companies, the Facebooks, the Googles, shouldn't be able to sell your health data, your financial data. Do we have bills pending in the legislature, bills you're leading the charge on, that would make that illegal in Massachusetts?
Not that I'm aware of. And look, there are some things that we need to deal with on the federal level with some of that because of preemption issues and what the FCC will allow, for example, or not allow. There's always going to be First Amendment issues raised whenever you try to limit what those will term as speech. But I think it's absolutely imperative. And right now, the platforms are not where they need to be. You know, and we need to, through Congress and through law enforcement, get the platforms at the table and have them seriously reform their practices. And, you know, absent that, I just think things are going to continue to get worse and worse. Everybody complains to me about robocalls. It's kind of a similar situation when it comes to the robocalls. At the end of the day, I can't investigate and chase people who become, you know, I can't chase all these robocallers. Many of these calls are emanating from computers or overseas. But you know who can change some of that? Our service providers, by installing the technology that'll like block that stuff. And again, this is where you need national leadership. We've come together as AGs to demand that Congress act on this. But you know, technology is a wonderful, wonderful thing, but it certainly brings with it any number of hazards. And you know, it can't just be on law enforcement to catch up. We need proactive action and leadership.
We're talking to the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, Maura Healey. She's with us taking our calls and our questions, that is, and your phone calls and emails, which I'm going to get to after the break. She's going to stay with us. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The Attorney General of the Commonwealth will be with us for another 20 minutes. If you want to talk to her, give her a buzz, 877-301-8970.
Attorney General, we had a couple of emails from a guy named John who wants to know how he can clear a false positive. I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse. A false positive that shows up on a Cori check. He has a decade and a half of teaching experience, multiple levels, middle school to college, master's degree, PhD, and he says he can't even find a job in Home Depot, and he's been having a really difficult time, and it was a mistaken identity kind of thing. What should he do?
Stay on the line, John, and we'll get you connected to our civil rights division. We actually have a Cori project within our office, and
great.
We'll see if there's anything we can do to help you so that your record really reflects the accuracy. And I think, you know, one of the things with this new criminal justice reform law that I'm anxious to help in further implementing, one of the things that was addressed is making reentry, the ability to return to life, to go to school, to get a job, so important to make that easier. So, John, stay on the line, and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, stay on the line, and our producers
will... Actually, he's not on the line. He's an emailer. We'll forward the email.
Yeah,
just send it to us. Send it to me.
Actually, is there an email, or is it just the phone number? Is there an email to send things to you?
Sure.
What is it?
The phone number is 617-727-8400.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the email...
Oh, I think we stumped the Attorney General.
No, you didn't. I mean, you can always go Maura.Healy at state. My team's going to kill me. Maura.Healy at mass.gov. But that's one way
I'm
to do it.
I'm taking it down to
her coworker looks like
Maura.Healy at mass.gov.
.gov.
You can do it, though, but
is there a mass in there somewhere?
Yeah, no, there used to be. It's mass.gov. But also social media, it's at mass.ago. Instagram
late.
At mass_AGO. You can hit us through Facebook, and I am sure that we can give you an email. If you the other thing too is if you just go on our website, there's an easy way to click and file a complaint.
All right, John, I just forwarded your email. I hope I don't screw it up.
To me,
you know,
yes.
Before we get back to the
all
calls,
right, John, I'll be back too soon.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 states have joined, I think, your colleague in California, mm-hmm. the Attorney General, suing the Trump administration over this declaration of a national emergency vis-a-vis the border. You're not amongst, we are not amongst them. Why not?
Not yet. Basically, I wanted to have, our lawyers are taking a little bit more time so that we can adequately count what the harm is potentially. We wanted to make sure we understood military projects here, infrastructure projects here.
That might lose
even
funding
drug
as
enforcement
a result, I see.
Work here that might lose funding as a result of this move. So I anticipate we'll see action shortly.
You know, Jim Brady put gas in his home the same day that there was a terrible explosion up in
True.
Lawrence and Andover. Yeah,
the
was
same
timing,
day.
Timing was great. But I only mentioned that in the context
of
this story about Massachusetts natural gas hookups are off limits in more towns. It has something to do with an overcapacity and the gas companies are frozen new gas hookups. I don't really understand what's going on here. I know that the governor thinks we need more natural gas, and you've expressed some concern about more natural gas capacity. So what's happening?
Well, I think what's happening here in Massachusetts is that we've seen this move towards growing our portfolio. I think we've got exciting wind, both onshore and offshore options coming online. Hydro now, with a recent move in Maine, it looks like. And certainly solar's been here. In terms of gas, you know, I think it's important that we maintain the right balance. And what that specifically is about, there are some places where certain utilities are claiming that they're not going to be able to provide the hookups, they're not going to be able to have the gas. I think each of those are, you know, bear closer review
okay.
and analysis. But I think one thing that's you know, happened with gas as it's become cheaper and cheaper, it's really, really important that we continue on a path here in this state towards meeting serious climate goals. We need it for sustainability, and we need it to protect the planet. I think it's also heartening to see the New England states and others come together and work regionally on some of this, including around procurements, and that's where we need to go. One of the reasons I sue the Trump administration so much over environmental rollbacks and changes to regulation is because every time they try to do that, it undermines our clean energy economy here, and the more than 100,000 clean energy jobs in Massachusetts, 100,000 jobs and growing. So, you know, we need to continue to really set a mark and make sure that we're out there. Interestingly enough, you know, when it came to gas, remember a few years ago I was in a lawsuit about this because
yes.
I didn't feel it was fair for the ratepayers, you and me and businesses, to foot the bill for a natural gas company to come in and build a pipeline. I'm not anti-natural gas. What I'm anti is having us foot the bill for that and let the shareholders and executives take the ride, see if it works out, but not bear the risk. And actually, the court upheld my position on that, that electric ratepayers shouldn't have to foot that bill. And you know what happened when the ratepayers weren't going to have to pay?
What?
The gas companies didn't come and build.
That's
so,
right.
So, you know, that's kind of what you got to look out for.
While we're on energy, what's going on with Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant and its sale?
Well, we've just looked to intervene down there in that action. This is a really, really important matter, not just for the folks in the South Coast and the Cape, but really for our state and the region. Pilgrim, it's a plant that's been decommissioned, so it's in the process of shutting down. You've got spent fuel that you need to account for and store properly, and we have real concerns that the funds are not there to be able to do this well. So as an office, we've intervened in a legal action demanding that the NRC act and take action to ensure that there are funds there that will allow for the safe decommissioning and closing down of this plant, and importantly, safe storage of
spent fuel. So your concern is radiation being leaked?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. You know, absolutely. We've seen these disasters before. And, you know, it's been a plant that has been a source of a lot of trouble, a number of safety violations over the years. And folks in that region are really rightly concerned about what's happening. And we will be there as strong an advocate as possible for the people in that region.
We're talking to the Attorney General. That's obviously her voice, Maura Healey. She's with us for another 15 minutes. Mike from Framingham, you're on Boston Public Radio with the Attorney General. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
From personal experience, I believe gambling is just as destructive as prostitution to families. And I won't go into it. I'll never be able to finish it emotionally, but I can tell you this much. We allow gambling, which completely destroys people's lives, but yet we don't allow prostitution. They both are the same. In fact, most casinos are a direct link to prostitution. I've been to only a couple in my life, and they weren't to gamble. One was for a concert, and one was for a pool tournament, where my pool team won our local regional championship and went to Las Vegas to play the national championship, and it was at the Rio.
Hey, Mike, I hate to interrupt. What's the question? Is there a question for the Attorney General, or you're just making a comment?
Well, it's a comment, meaning that why is the casino and gambling okay and prostitution not? Neither should be okay. And it's just amazing. When I was robbed at that casino.
Okay, we understand the underlying question. You want to respond to the whole casino issue there, Attorney General?
Sure. Casinos are illegal here in Massachusetts because the legislature passed a law and the governor signed a bill. My position on casinos, I think, is pretty clear and well-documented. I opposed casinos back in 2014 when I was running and opposed the ballot initiative at the time.
They would have repealed the law, by the way. The people said, let's keep them.
Yep. So, you know, they are here. And, Mike, I completely appreciate what you're alluding to in terms of the dangers of gambling and addiction and exploitation and all of that. And I will continue to be a strong consumer advocate to look out for the interests of those who are out there, particularly now as we move towards consideration of online betting and online sports betting.
Our number is 877-301-8970. One last gas-related question. I have to say, well, we've never done a count. If I had to total up the email, tweets, and calls that Charlie Baker gets when he joins us, the issue that probably is the top of the list is this compressor in Weymouth. And the interesting part is there are a number of local politicians, mayors in particular, very supportive of Charlie Baker, who are very unhappy about the fact that his DEP gave an air quality permit to this compressor in Weymouth. And I don't have the exact quote, but essentially what the governor has said is they had no choice but to grant it based upon what the statute says. Do you agree with the governor's conclusion about the lack of discretion based on the facts for the department of whatever DEP stands for?
Yeah, the department has the prerogative and has the responsibility to look at the law and then look at the proposal. And, you know, my understanding is they did that and they decided to issue the permit.
Do you have a problem with the permit?
I understand people's concern. You know, I heard a lot about it myself when I've been in the area. And, you know, I certainly take those concerns seriously. And this may be challenged, and we'll see how this goes forward.
Speaking of challenge, I have to say we got a ton of email after you were here last time about this lawsuit vis-a-vis the Sacklers
sort
of thing. That was a month ago. Can you give us an update on, first of all, explain to people who weren't paying attention then or don't know what exactly, by the way, DEP, I'm humiliated, is Department of Environmental Protection, my apologies.
That was your Rick Perry moment.
What?
We have a lot of them here.
No, thank you very much. We do more and more every day. Yeah. So explain the
basis.
Isn't
that amazing, though? He was the guy left in charge for the State of the Union.
That is exactly right. He was this, what do they call that? Designated survivor or
God
whatever it is.
Help us.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the one who couldn't name the cabinet departments, right, in the debate that
right.
He wanted to eliminate
yes,
it.
That's
and
right.
Didn't Mitt Romney help him out by telling him what his third, whatever it was?
I don't remember.
In any case, explain the basis for
Purdue?
The litigation
yeah.
and what the
so,
status is.
So folks may know this, Purdue Pharma, they developed OxyContin, they marketed it and sold profuse amounts of this through the 90s and 2000s. Basically, Purdue Pharma is a privately held company controlled mostly by one family, the Sackler family. And basically, over time, what we saw is that, and what we learned, is that this was a company that was set on prescribing as many opioids as possible to as many people as possible at as high a dose as possible. It's conduct that they were tagged for by way of a criminal complaint and a plea agreement back in 2007, and two executives also pled guilty, and there was a $600 million fine. But here's what our investigation, my office's investigation, revealed. We filed a complaint recently that was made public, 275 pages, and it basically details the calculated and intentional efforts from 2007-04 by the board and its officers to continue with the practice of selling as many opioids as possible. Since 2007, 150 doctor's visits by Purdue representatives alone in Massachusetts. Millions and millions of prescriptions of Purdue products in Massachusetts alone since 2007. We've seen the devastation. We've seen the destruction. Ours was the office to go through the millions and millions of pages and documents and emails and memos. And based on Purdue's own memos and emails, we laid out and told the story of the marketing. And, you know, it even continued as late as 2013 and 14 with contemplation of new ways to make money, including making money on the back end by selling drugs that were going to deal with opioid addiction. So they were going to prescribe the opioids on the front end, and then they were going to make money on the back end. Now, they never ended up going through with that proposal, but it shows you what we're dealing with in terms of this company. So that's our suit. We filed it here in State Superior Court. There's a what's called a multi-district litigation because there's a bunch of states and cities and counties that have filed. Those have been consolidated out in a federal action in Ohio. We're not part of that. We're coming alone here, and we're the first to name the Sacklers and the executives and the directors. And I think that's really important, Jim, because at the end of the day, there were decisions made by individuals. Companies are not robots and machines. They're actually run and populated by humans with responsibility for controlling operations. And our investigation and what we allege is that executives and board members made decisions that resulted in the prescription and the sale of copious amounts of opioids here. We actually outlined, too, some 670 individual deaths tied to Purdue products in the state. So that work continues, and we'll continue to be in litigation.
You know, Attorney General, I know you said there was a criminal complaint and they paid a $600 million fine. We were talking earlier this morning with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, about some legislative proposals across the country to have even executions, death penalty for people that sell fentanyl, which is a pretty lethal drug, and higher prices, higher sentences for people who deal in opioids. And, you know, the obvious question is, well, you're gonna send away the street dealer for life or whatever, and then you see people that are at the top of the chain being prosecuted, but they're paying fines. Can there be any equalization?
Of course, and there should be, and there should be accountability. Look, we're pursuing this right now civilly against officers and directors and the company, and we'll seek the full recourse of the law. We'll also leave our options open as to what else may happen, but you know, it is absolutely imperative that we treat this for what it is, and we have a serious epidemic on our hands, and we need to hold accountable those who need to be held accountable. Just a little while ago, I actually charged a doctor with involuntary manslaughter. I'm anti-death penalty. I will never support the death penalty under any circumstance, but we charged a doctor who was prescribing to individuals in amounts that were so off the charts, and to individuals who were known to be sick and addicted. And in fact, one woman ended up dying.
Wow.
Attorney General, there are staff pulled a couple of emails since they feel that I give short shrift to the emails, unlike Marjorie. A couple of quick questions. Robert, I don't know from where, asks where you are on the notion of putting the lottery online. I'm sure I don't know if people know, the Treasurer, Deb Goldberg, has been lobbying the legislature for the last couple of years, particularly because she believes that if the lottery is to capture younger players, who are obviously the future, needs to go online. Do you support that?
I think I want to talk to the Treasurer more about it. I certainly would have concerns about the ability to have something in your pocket and with the click of a button be able to spend money. But that's something I haven't formed a full opinion on yet. I want to learn more.
Jim from Worcester, this is a common thing, emails. Several times I've nearly gotten hit by a flying sheet of ice off the top of another car as recently as yesterday. Why does Massachusetts not have an ice missile law like Connecticut and fine people who do not clear off the top of their trucks and cars? I think it's as bad as driving drunk, just not a danger to yourself as much as those around you. What's your response to that?
Well, something, Jim, that hadn't occurred to me. We'll take a look at it.
Great. We'll ask you about it next month. Jim, thank you very much for your email. We'll follow up on that.
Let's go to Nancy in Dedham. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
So
it is egregious that the pharmaceutical companies are exploiting people and the casinos are exploiting people's addictions. But I wonder whether you would entertain that sexual addiction is a legitimate affliction, and that just as the other people are sick and addicted, there's all kinds of studies that point to the fact that watching pornography creates a dopamine release that is addictive.
Nancy, I believe that there is that sex addiction is real. There are treatment facilities and treatment centers and providers who work with those who are addicted in that way, and I think that's important and that should continue. But I want to separate, though, that from what we're talking about earlier when it comes to actual acts. Acts that are illegal. And it may be the case that somebody should be prosecuted and also treated. I think we should separate, too, the discussion of pornography from what we're seeing, which I think Nancy alluded to, talking about pornography, from what we're seeing happening in these massage parlors and in these motels and in these brothels when it comes to actual sex acts and what that's about. And more often than not, you know, the Johns in our cases typically tend to be lawyers, doctors, professors, white-collar workers, and I think that there's been interesting discussion about power and what this is about, and I think that there needs to be more focus on some of that and understanding what it is that is feeding this really insidious industry. Human trafficking, by the way, is the fastest-growing criminal enterprise in the world. And,
wow.
You know, I just think we need to do everything we can to raise awareness, to recognize the signs of human trafficking, and to do everything we can to combat it.
Attorney General, thank you. Oh, actually, before you go, we all read these stories.
By the way, Barbara just asked me a question, too. Are you dealing with the trafficking of boys as well? Absolutely, Barbara, and I don't mean to suggest through my comments that this is exclusive to girls or women. It is not. You're absolutely right. Boys are involved as well.
So before you go, we all read the story about everything that goes on inside your physical office, the pink flamingos, the basketballs. And I will say for the record, even though this is not an on-air conversation, Maura Healey did invite Marjorie Egan to come
visit
her office.
I want to go play
basketball.
And then
said, when she heard that I heard that, she said, maybe you could come sometime too, Jim. Thank you for the invitation.
Maybe.
How many basketballs do you have in your office? They didn't say how many. All they said, there are tons of them everywhere you turn. How many basketballs?
I lost count. It's great. I love going out. People give me basketballs. And,
is Kuzi really your all-time guy?
Yeah, that's why I wore 14 from third grade on. I played
because
for the Holy
of Bob Kuzi.
Yeah, I played for the Holy Cross Crusaders. That
Absolutely.
Was my youth association team, and then I was obviously a Celtics fan. And so you know, you put the two together, and your point guard. What else? Are you
is he the greatest point guard that ever lived?
I think he did things that revolutionized the game. Yeah. He was also, you know, he's also the guy. He started the Players Union. There are things that he's not known for.
Know
doesn't
that.
Get credit for. But he started the Players Union, and you know, there's also a new book out on his life and his relationship with Bill Russell, and I commend that to folks. But he is a really interesting and a wonderful person who I've enjoyed spending time with.
Marjorie, will you tell me what her office is like when you visit so I'll get to know secondhand?
Actually,
is that possible?
I told the Attorney General I was there previously when Martha Coakley was the Attorney General.
Well, apparently you're going again.
It's quite a view.
Enjoy yourself. Maura Healey, we really appreciate
Thank you
your
very
time.
Much.
Thanks so much.
All
Good
right.
to see you.
Great to be with you both.
Attorney General Maura Healey joins us once a month to take our calls and your emails and your calls and our questions. I'm goofing that one up. Anyway, thank you very much, Attorney General Healey. We very much appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Up next, CNN's John King joins us to go over day one of Michael Cohen's testimony. He is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. By the way, before, when the Attorney General was leaving, the office, the best office address, if you have issues, is AGO, as Attorney General's office, AGO@mass.gov. Joining us online to go over the latest political headlines is John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. John, as you know, is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Hello, John King.
Happy Tuesday.
And to
Happy
you.
Happy Tuesday to you too, John King. So Michael Cohen is testifying behind closed doors today down in Washington, D.C. We're going to see him tomorrow in person. Do you know anything yet about what he had to say?
Oh, we haven't heard much in the details. We've had a few senators go in and out of the room and give us a little bit on the subject matters, but it is a classified hearing, so they're not supposed to talk about it. They say, but we are told that, you know, remember, he was, one of the things he was convicted of was lying to the
right.
same committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they say that he is explaining himself and saying, yes, here's where I lied and here's the truth. Beyond that, you know, how much is he implicating anyone else? And of course, people have the question, is he implicating people at the White House, perhaps including the President of the United States? We don't know that yet. We'll continue to keep reporting that one, but this is day one of day three, and there's no doubt tomorrow is going to be a remarkable public spectacle. The question then is, what do we get for either new information or verified information? The White House is right. They put out a statement calling him a liar, saying no one should believe him. He's proven liar. He's going to jail for it. But the president also has a problem with the truth a lot. So we're going to find out. Cohen says that the president continued a pattern of lawbreaking even after he was sworn in as president of the United States. If he can prove that, that's a big deal.
So speaking of truth, we learned last week, I guess, and it was wrong, that Bob Mueller would be submitting his confidential report to Attorney General Barr this week. And then I guess we read earlier this week that it's likely not going to happen this week, even though the objective indicia, for lack of a better expression, fewer lawyers, some of the lawyers saying we're coming back to the law firm, suggests he is drawing to a close. How confident are the Democrats, like Adam Schiff, chair of the Intelligence Committee, that if William Barr decides to disclose very little of this, that they have the power through subpoenaing the report, through subpoenaing Mueller himself, to get the bulk of this in view of the American people, John?
You get a big debate on that question, Jim. They certainly promise, the Democrats promise they will try. And they say that if, you know, for some reason Barr says, I'm not going to release this, that, or the other thing, you know, he does have to send up the conclusions. So when he sends up the conclusions and they start to say, where are the underlying documents, I think we're going to see a big fight about this. I think, number one, can you subpoena Mueller? You know, does not say in the special counsel regulations that he has to testify to Congress. He's an institutional guy. He has respect for the system. I could see a possibility where he goes and sits in a chair and then just says, I'm not going to answer a lot of questions. But I don't want to get the cart too far in front of the horse, but there's no question Democrats say we are going to fight for this. I was in Iowa over the weekend, and Senator Kamala Harris put on the proposal the idea that, you know, you get some of it in a classified setting. But even then, you know, you just had the Attorney General of Massachusetts on the program. She could tell you that there are cases where you believe somebody's guilty, you feel it in your bones, you can close your eyes and see it, but you can't prove it. And so a prosecutor has to bite their lip and bite their tongue and swallow their pride at that moment and put the file away. You know, you don't go out, as James Comey did, and say, we had this long investigation, and we found a whole lot of things that were terrible, but we can't prove a crime. You don't normally do that. You put the file away and you bite your tongue. If you can keep investigating, you do. But so the question is, if Mueller has interviewed all these people, explored all these questions, and has a lot of, maybe even a little bit of smoke, but can't connect the dots, the Democrats say they want to see that information. That is not what happens if you're investigated for, you know, bank fraud or tax fraud or, you know, other crimes. The prosecutor puts the file away. So I think we're going to have a big fight here. Now, the Democrats' argument is, number one, that maybe there aren't criminal offenses, but maybe there are things that Congress has every right to investigate. Maybe there are campaign finance or other regulatory violations. We could refer to other federal agencies if Bob Mueller hasn't done that. And they also say, and this is where I think it's going to get interesting, the president may have victimized himself here, if you will, that the president ordered the Justice Department, pressured the Justice Department to release all the memos about the Hillary Clinton email investigation, even though she was never charged. So the Democrats are going to say, fair play. You got to look at all the underlying documents in the Clinton investigation. We want them in the Mueller investigation.
You know, John, Marjorie and I were talking earlier about how we learn a lot from your travels out in the world talking to real voters. You just did that in Iowa. But you mentioned the Kamala Harris thing. And I thought one part of your interview with her, which in Iowa, which is of great significance for big thinkers in the Democratic Party is this. You were talking to her and asking about how you pay for things like Medicare for All, how you pay for things like the Green New Deal. And here's what Senator Harris had to say to you, John King.
It's not about a cost. It's about an investment. And then the question should be, is it worth the cost in terms of the investment potential? Are we going to get back more than we put in?
So when Mayor Bloomberg, Amy Klobuchar, some of your potential fellow Democrats say, no, it's too much, it's too ambitious, it's too expensive, you think they're wrong?
I look forward to that debate on the debate stage.
And I look forward to not answering your question right now about what the actual cost are. The, as I'm saying, the big thinking Democrats who were in embracing, I would say, almost revolutionary change or dramatic change in the system, are they going to get hung up on that issue about how do you pay for these things that people appear to want but have huge price tags attached to them?
Well, I think it's going to be a defining issue in the Democratic race in the sense that let's assume there's more centrist candidates. Number one, you have Amy Klobuchar in the race now. Mayor Bloomberg is looking at it. We're still waiting on the Vice President Joe Biden. There are lesser-known candidates like John Delaney, who's a former congressman from Maryland and a businessman, who says, look, I love all those ideas. How are you going to pay for them? We can't do this. We have $22 trillion in national debt. We are running mind-boggling still annual budget deficits. My question is, number one, has the country moved that far left? My first campaign was the Dukakis campaign. I was the kid from Boston covering Dukakis, who lost 40 states. 40 states. Had a 17-point lead at his convention and lost 40 states after Walter Mondale lost 49 states because the Republicans said the pie-in-the-sky liberals want to spend all your money and we can't afford this. Has the country moved that much? Now, Donald Trump is not exactly a fiscal conservative. We have a Republican president who's running up big deficits. Mm-hmm. So maybe the American people don't care anymore. That's why we have elections, and we'll find out. I do think Democrats say they campaigned on all these things in 2018, and they won all these House seats, therefore America's ready for this. Winning a House seat, even a tough House seat, is different than winning the presidency. I'm fascinated by the question. I don't have the answer, Jim, but my history, this is my ninth presidential campaign, my history says you're going to have a hard time winning over independents and conservative-minded voters who may well be Democrats, but who want their governor to balance the budget, for example, who have to balance their family budget, for example, if you have a Green New Deal, reparations for slavery, Medicare for All, and other expensive programs, and you can't lay it out. I don't want to pick on Senator Harris. There are a number of other Democrats doing the same thing right now. It's also early in the campaign, and candidates grow. They listen to voters. And to me, that's the fascinating stage we're in, to watch them grow and watch them evolve. And some of these answers might evolve. I do have a question. Elizabeth Warren, for example, says have that mega tax on the rich. She, at least, you could disagree with her proposal, but she has laid out a plan on paper where you can see the government would raise this much revenue. And then she says, here's how we're going to spend it. Now, you might, there are some people who say that will stifle the economy, that rich people will find ways around it, they'll hide money. That's one debate, but at least she has laid out a plan. Here's my tax plan. We'll raise this much money. I'm going to spend this on child care. I'm going to spend this on health care, and so on and so forth. That's why we have elections and we have debates. This Democratic Party, remember, Bernie Sanders said these things 4 years ago or 3 years ago in the 2016 campaign, and Hillary Clinton said they're too liberal, too expensive, too idealistic, too unrealistic. Now, a lot of the Democrats in the race agree, or at least in general agree, with Bernie Sanders. The party has moved left. But we're in the early chapters of this. Let's see how it plays out.
But you know what, John King? I could be totally all wet. You know a lot more about this than I do. But I keep going back to the fact that Donald Trump ran as a populist. Up in New Hampshire, we said this a million times. We would ask people during the primaries, who are you for? Well, I'm deciding between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And you think, how could you possibly be doing that? Because they both ran as populists. So my theory is, and I could be absolutely crazy, that after 40 years of being told, oh, don't worry, trickle-down economics. Oh, don't worry, we'll cut taxes on the rich and they'll create all these jobs. Oh, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. And you saw during the federal shutdown, all these stories about not only were federal workers by the tens of thousands, paycheck to paycheck workers, but so were, depending on who you believe, 60 to 70% of Americans. So if this is such a great economy, maybe it dawns on people that this is a great economy and yet I'm still, I can't pay $400 to get my car fixed, that maybe the jig is up. And that's why you hear people talking about things that seemed crazy, because if you look at polls, that's what the polls say.
I think you have a great point about on the populism argument, and the question is, can the Democrats make the case to enough voters that President Trump fooled you, that he's not on your side, that he said he was going to be for you? Remember, he said famously, I am your voice. And instead, he passed a big tax cut that benefits the wealthy and the corporations. And yes, we have 4% unemployment, but a lot of you are still working two jobs, right, or three jobs. And
right.
How much of your wage has gone up? Now, there are some statistics in the president's favor here in the sense that wages have started to grow at a faster rate than they did in the Obama years. And again, the Democrat listening is going to say, yeah, you idiot, we were coming out of a recession. It was a tough time. And that's true. We were coming out of a recession. I'm just saying that there are economic statistics that work in this president's favor politically. And the question is, who can best make that argument? But to the point, I'll tell you, you hear about drug prices at these town halls from voters. You hear about health care costs still. You hear about the stress of globalization and working two or three jobs and wages. If a Democrat can kick into that, can you have an aspirational candidacy that says we're going to battle climate change, we're going to improve health care, and we're going to do some of these other things where it's not so much about the math, it's about the North Star? Yes, I think that's a possibility. However, I also do think there will be some voters who say, I'm trying to add all this up, and the math's getting pretty overwhelming.
So, John, I always look for an opportunity to ask you a trivia question, so here's it. I'm sure it's going to make you nervous. You mentioned your first presidential campaign was Michael Dukakis. Actually, let me ask Marjorie this question, see if she can answer before you.
I hate quizzes.
Who was the young reporter in the Dukakis campaign who broke the news that Lloyd Bentsen from Texas was Dukakis' running mate?
It was John, wasn't it?
John
yeah,
King.
Yeah, John King. That's right.
Was that the first big political story you broke, John King?
I guess so. Certainly national that it was, and that helped me. I always laugh about the smart people in Washington. I love my bosses in Washington. Don't get me wrong. I worked at the Associated Press in those days. But the idea was that the kid could cover Dukakis because he wasn't going to get the nomination, and they kept trying to sequence me out to write stories on the Massachusetts Record, or I was going to get to cover Kitty Dukakis maybe a little bit at the convention. So I had to break news to convince them. Keep giving the kid a chance, and that was a big one in the. I wouldn't be here today, I don't think, without that story. Let's put it that
okay,
way.
So let's fast forward 30 years. You sit down with a Republican senator, and you ask him or her the following question. Why is it that what you, Senator, would consider a power grab by a Democratic president when he was unhappy with what Congress did to be a constitutional abomination, and you appear ready to vote to sustain this president's declaration of a national emergency because he didn't get the money he wanted from Congress? What would a Republican sitting one-on-one with you, how would they answer that question?
Oh, some of them would come up with a clever way, and the others would just sit there and go, uh-huh, or Donald Trump is president. You raise a key point about hypocrisy, or what I would say is the very limited shelf life of principle here in the nation's capital. And there are, you can make this argument against Democrats on some issues, but you're right. Number one, the Republicans like to call themselves constitutional conservatives. The Constitution says Congress appropriates money. Congress mm-hmm. decides how money is spent in this country, not the executive. And so there is every reason to say, as there was in some of these things in the Obama administration, You can agree with President Obama's goals. He went outside the norms on several occasions. DACA and the Dreamers, the one that comes up the most, to do things because he couldn't get Congress to do them. And so you could, if you're a Democrat, you might say he had to. Okay, but it was going outside the norms. Now Republicans, most of them, because they're afraid of this president, and let's be honest, we live in a political society, 85 to 90% of Republicans support Donald Trump. And so if you're a Republican senator, you can raise your hand and say this is against all of our principles, this is against our history, this is against the Constitution. The president's going to do it. So I'm fascinated by the number of Republican defections. The House will vote on that this afternoon. It will pass because the Democrats have a majority. But how many Republicans break ranks? And then the Senate will vote. I believe it will pass, but not by a lot. There are three Republicans. You need four if all the Democrats vote to overturn the national emergency. Three are already on record, and there are I know at least 10 more who would like to vote with the Democrats, but I bet it doesn't get that high because of pressure from their leadership.
Well, I was going to ask you about John King, about Bob Kraft, John King, but we're out of time, so I don't have to ask you about that
today. Thank God.
I know.
I had a feeling you'd be
It's a tough situation.
Hey, John, it's great to talk to you,
thank
as
you
always.
Very much.
Take care, everybody.
John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon, Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Thank you very much, John, as always. Up next, The World's Carolyn Beeler joins us from aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer research vessel with an update from her expedition through Antarctica, the icebergs she's seen. She's arrived at Thwaites Glacier, and she's going to tell us about their sauna club that they have on the Nathaniel B. Palmer to kill time when they're not out looking at those spectacular icebergs. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, broadcasting from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Carolyn Beeler, the world's environmental reporter, is 4 weeks into her expedition to Antarctica, living among scientists who are sailing toward the Thwaites Glacier to study how quickly it will melt and what it will mean for global sea levels and coastal cities. And this morning, around 4 a.m., they got to Thwaites, which is one of the largest glaciers in Antarctica. Carolyn Beeler, great to talk to you.
You too.
So tell us, what does this thing look like?
It looks like a giant sheer cliff of ice stretching in either direction as far as you can see. And when we arrived this morning around 4 a.m. our time, about 2 a.m. Boston time, it was still dark and it was snowing. So the captain and chief mate were using a spotlight to look for ice chunks to miss. But we could see this big, you know, cliff of ice on our left. We've been following it for hours ever since. And as we've gotten away from where we started and gotten into areas where the ice sheet is more degraded, it's changed a bit. It's gotten a little wavy on top, and there are parts that are sloping gently instead of being a sheer cliff. So we're already seeing, you know, some of the changes that are happening down here.
Yeah, I know, Carolyn, you said when you saw some of the icebergs before, they were twice as big, as tall as your ship. How tall is this cliff? Ballpark.
So is the captain... Yeah, the captain estimated this morning anywhere between 45 and 70 feet, roughly. So it's tall, but it's not particularly tall for an ice sheet like this, as I understand it.
And am I right that no one has, a human being has never been there before? You were the guys, the first guys. Is that right?
Yeah, we believe that we're the first people to be where we are right now. Where we are now or where we were half an hour ago or so is part of a place where they used to be. Thwaites Glacier actually jutted out farther into the sea, and it's broken off. So it's not been possible to come where we are before. And we're heading into an area that was not the glacier itself, but has been covered in, you know, this flat frozen sea ice for years. And so it's also been inaccessible to ship traffic. So everything that is being done in terms of mapping the seafloor and taking out water quality, you know, water measurements, is all new data for science. So it's really a new frontier for science. And the scientists are very excited to finally be here after a month of transit and some delays and some working in other parts of the sea down here.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit later about stopping off at a base up there for medical evaluation. But just let's get back to the icebergs and Thwaites itself. I know that you described these icebergs as being unbelievably beautiful. Blue. I mean, all we, you know, we think of icebergs here, we think of the Titanic, you know what I'm saying? So I'm, you know, that's all you think about is that movie that we all obsessed over. But describe it, the colors, what it looks like.
Yeah, so the icebergs we've seen have been incredibly varied in size and shape. I mean, you have ones that look like, you know, have parts that look like castle turrets, and some that have been so weathered and eroded that they look like giant sleeping animals. You know, they're much smoother. Some look like mountain ranges with pointy peaks, and a lot are what are called tabular icebergs, which are chunks that have broken off of ice sheets like Thwaites that we're sailing down right now, that are sort of flat rectangles. And the textures vary, and one of the most astonishing things is this blue. Is, you know, these icebergs have crevasses and cracks running down them where someday they will crack. And there's this sort of
cerulean, like blue, like the bluest sky you've ever seen, sort of glowing out of these cracks. So there's some really interesting colors down here.
We're talking to Carolyn Beeler. She's the world environmental reporter who's in on an expedition right now and talking to us from Antarctica. So you mentioned the erosion, Carolyn, and how some of the icebergs are flattened out and how Thwaites is uneven. So you don't know yet what this means in terms of quickness of melting, but this is obviously indication of some melting.
Yeah, so the icebergs, you know, these detached pieces of ice that are floating around always weather in different ways and eventually, you know, disappear. But the ice sheet itself, this sort of waviness of the top of it that I was describing and this sloping downward, that is thought to be signs of thinning and melting underneath, you know, in the underwater portion of this of the ice sheet, the floating edge where we are right now. So, you know, it's known that it's retreating and melting at a pretty rapid rate, Thwaites, and the scientists on the ship are doing a lot to understand, you know, what is driving that now, how it compares to what happened in the past, so that modelers in the future can sort of put all these numbers into models and figure out what's to come.
Okay, how long are you going to be right by Thwaites? How long will this part of the expedition last?
So we have something like 20 science days left, I believe. We have a month left. So I think we have about 20 science days, and most of that will be down here by Thwaites. We won't always be quite so close to the face of the glacier glacier itself, because we'll be doing some work on the sea floor a little bit farther out, but we'll be here for a good bit of time. Because of the delays that we've experienced, it's possible that we're going to extend the trip for a couple of extra days time down here.
And you mentioned before that when you got there at 4 in the morning to Thwaites, it was still dark. How dark? How many hours of darkness are there right now, this February in Antarctica?
Yeah, I think a couple of hours of it was kind of foggy today, so you know it was sort of that like white darkness, not totally dark. But it's actually changed a lot because we've gone pretty far north to south the past week and a half or so for this medical evacuation. So the times of dark and at night have changed a lot because we've gone north to south, and the days are getting the nights are getting a little longer. But I think there were, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 hours dark. It just shifted right now pretty early in the morning. So it doesn't get dark early in the morning and then gets late at 7. So you actually kind of, the past couple of days, I haven't known when it's going to be dark and light.
So is that hard or is that okay because you're inside, when you're sleeping inside the boat?
Yeah, so it's fine for me because it's getting light around, like today it got light around 6:30 or something, which is, you know, pretty normal for you know, Boston winter or something like that. And it's light when I go to bed at 11 or so, but, you know, it's a little bit.
So you mentioned in one of your correspondence to Chelsea, our producer, you guys got ping pong tournaments going, bridge lessons, sauna clubs, kind of pass the time before you have to do your work. What's going on the boat to keep you occupied?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there was this medical evacuation, which, you know, was necessary, and everyone was glad to get this person who needed help safely to the nearest research base, but did add about 10 days basically waiting for scientists. So there have been some, you know, samples to sort and process, and folks have given science talks and gone over papers, but they've also come up with more creative ways to keep morale up, I suppose. So someone instituted a ping pong tournament, which is almost at the final game.
Are you good at ping pong, Carolyn? Did you last long?
I didn't. I was out on the first round.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. But that's still good. And what's a sauna club?
So there's a sauna on the ship. It's not a luxury ship by any means. It's comfortable, but, you know, not a cruise ship.
Yeah.
But we do have one thing that I think of as a bit of a luxury, which is the sauna, which is really nice for people when they've been out working in the cold all day. So somebody has just instituted, you know, a time to encourage people to go to the sauna together and then, you know, go to the sauna for a bit and then walk out to the deck to cool off and watch the icebergs.
Oh. Yes, while you were in your bathing suit.
Okay. Sounds kind of fun. We're talking to Karen Beeler. She's on an expedition for the world to Antarctica, to the Thwaites Glacier. So you mentioned that there was someone that needed medical attention and you had to stop at this small base. Are there a lot of bases up there to stop at, or how big of a deal or emergency was this?
So there are not a lot of bases. So we were at one of the British bases that happened to be the closest. There are five British bases. I don't know what the total number is on Antarctica, but you know, it took us 4 days to get to the nearest base with an airstrip that could get somebody safely to South America so they could get to medical attention. So a medical evacuation down here, you know, is something that's serious and it's taken seriously, and it does take a lot of time. So there's really strict physical qualifications that everyone has to pass before they can come on a trip like this. Because there's no doctor on the ship. So, you know, if you need medical attention and you need to see a doctor in person, not just over the phone, you know, it's often, you know, means several days of sailing somewhere else.
And when you get to this base, what is the base like? Is it just sitting in the middle of the ice somewhere?
So the one we went to is on a little island that's just off of the sort of middle part of the Antarctic Peninsula. So there's this bit of a tail that sort of comes off the top of Antarctica that points toward the tip of South America. So that's where this base was called. It's called Rothera, is located. It's a British base. It has something like 130 folks there right now. So it's in this bay that actually has, it's beautiful. There's these, you know, jaggedy volcanic mountains, and it's sort of just this little base nestled in among these mountains. And I heard it described as, you know, a mining town. There's some long row green buildings for labs and places to live. The base itself is, you know, nothing too exciting to look at, but the location is quite beautiful.
Okay, and these people are just there doing research, or what are they doing there?
Yeah, so it's mostly sort of a home base for researchers who will fly out to nearby glaciers to study them, or ice streams. They have some biologists who actually dive in the bay right there at the base to collect sediment samples and marine organisms to study, you know, how they survive in such cold temperatures and how they're adapting to climate change, things like that. So it's all, yes, this is totally a science base.
So, Carolyn, we have about a minute left, but so what's the plan from here? You're there. You arrived this morning at 4 o'clock. What's the plan going forward?
So right now we're doing, you know, following the edge of as much of the glacier as we can get to map the bottom of the seafloor in this uncharted area. And that will give the scientists on board more information about where they would like to drill down to do some sediment cores, or it's not drilling, but it's like sticking a giant straw into the seabed to pull up sediment to study what has happened here in the past. They're also sort of scouting locations to send an automated submarine down to do some really sort of high detail fine grade mapping of the seafloor. And also they're going to be doing a whole bunch of water samples along the front of the glacier to better understand to what extent some warmer ocean water is getting up to this glacier to melt it.
Well, listen, I hope everything goes smoothly from here on out. And I love the pictures you've been sending, the reports you've been making. And thanks for talking to us, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. That was the world's Carolyn Beeler. She's aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer on an expedition to Thwaites Glacier. She's got about 3 more weeks to go in Antarctica. Follow along the journey on the world, theworld.org, and on Instagram at PRI the world. Thanks for talking to us, Carolyn, and thank you all for joining us. Thank you for being down here at the Boston Public Library and listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Here and at home, you can find us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tune in tomorrow for our coverage all day, as long as it lasts, of Michael Cohen's testimony. And starting tomorrow, by the way, here at the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library, we are kicking off a weekly series, Next Stop. It's on all things transportation, hosted by Bob C. That's starting tomorrow at 3 o'clock right here at the Boston Public Library, so check it out. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, our on-site engineers, Ron Milton and Chris Anderson, and special thanks, as always, to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe. I'm Marjorie Egan. Jim Bride will be back tomorrow. Thanks again for listening to WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Have a great afternoon.